A wondrous Wednesday, Bill.
Let's hope it is, Wendy.
Oh, I don't think it's going to be.
Well, it's nicer outside. I'm trying to find the positive. Yesterday, very cold, very windy, very snowy. Today, much sunnier, much more mild. Still cold. It's going to be cold till.
I'm not talking about the weather, Bill.
The political climate? Is that what you're talking about? What are you talking about?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, that's still really cold. The political climate is very, very, very cold. I watched a lot of the coverage last night from various states and from various angles, and I don't know if I admire the guys that just don't seem to have a chance at this point. There's a couple of candidates that just don't seem to have any kind of a chance.
I think I can.
That's what I keep hearing.
Why do you admire them?
Well,
because they don't give up?
I love that in a person. I love the ability to not give up. But on the flip side of that coin, at some point you look at the numbers and you go, this is, it's not impossible, but it's just this side of impossible. So you have to be fairly realistic, don't you?
Yeah, I say, cut the ties and save some money.
That's what I keep thinking.
A lot of it's not their money. They've got the money now, so.
But they
just don't like to lose, and Bill doesn't like to lose more than me.
I hate to lose. I can't stand losing. But at some point, when you're down by what these guys are down, when you're not getting any delegates and any support, what's in it for Ben Carson at this point? What's in it for John Kasich at this point to say, I'm not going anywhere. I'm in this thing to the end.
Well, Carson says that he's doing it for the people who support him. He doesn't want to let them down.
That is an admirable trait.
It is.
Why?
Well, because then you can go to bed when this is all over with and sleep at night knowing that at least you gave it your go.
Well, he's going to have to tell those people one day or another.
I think they'll find out.
Right. And in Kasich's strategy has always been the North and the Midwest. So, he almost pulled off a shocker in Vermont.
Right.
Was it Vermont? Yeah, last night.
Right.
He came close to Trump, but he's not going anywhere until they vote in Ohio and in Michigan. He's just not going to because his strategies, it's almost like judging him by a game he's not playing.
Right.
He's not playing in the South. He's playing up in the North and Midwest.
So go to the end and then, you gave it your all.
I just love watching the candidates and, the way they sort of couch things. Marco Rubio was saying Ted Cruz had a terrible night. And, Cruz crushed him. But
Were you watching the same interview with Jake Tapper that I was watching last night? Is that where you heard that?
I don't remember where I saw it.
Were you guys together?
Yes. Steve and I, in our tree fort, we were watching all the
Tuesday
coverage.
Thing. We do it every 4 years.
All right. Jake Tapper at some point said, Are you being delusional? Because he was being so positive
about all
this.
Which you've brought up
this.
Before.
There's a lot of that. There really is. From every candidate on both sides, you could easily say that guy or that girl is being delusional when you look at what the numbers are. Because he wasn't claiming victory, but he was talking about what a good thing this was. But it wasn't a good thing. So Jake Tapper just said at some point, are you delusional? And I it's a great question.
And then Ted Cruz at one point, and this was before he had won, was it Alaska maybe? It was his last one. So he's giving a speech and he goes, in his sort of way, he's got that speaking mannerism. But he says, the voters have voted in 15 states and only two people have won, me and Donald Trump. It's like, well, yeah, but Trump has won 13.
He was factual in what he said,
though. He was absolutely factual.
But it's like saying between Leonardo DiCaprio and I, we have won an Academy Award.
Right. There was that joke at the Oscars, two Oscars on the stage.
Right, right.
Well,
I just cracked up.
I know.
And then Hillary Clinton last night, too. She's looks like it's nearly over there.
Yeah.
And so she gave a speech that was very similar to what she has been saying. But it also is like Bernie Sanders said, sounded a little like Bernie, because she's now going to go for that segment, too.
This was my favorite moment of last night, and I wrote down the woman's name who said it, and I didn't bring it in, and I apologize. But it was one of the political analysts for CNN. And it was right after Jake Tapper had spoken to Marco Rubio, who didn't do, despite what Marco Rubio was telling you last night and this morning, he didn't have the best night. And this political analyst, this woman, explained how his numbers were so poor, his showing was so poor yesterday, that this just doesn't hurt his chances of being president. It also hurts his chances of being vice president. Well, realistically, you've all seen what I've seen, the back and forth between Marco Rubio and Donald Trump. There's no way in the world he was under consideration for the role of vice president. 0% chance. Mm. But she said it as though That's how bad tonight was. Now Marco Rubio might not even be asked to be the vice president.
It's funny you say that, because Kevin, what are your thoughts about why these people, especially Ben Carson, staying in this?
Okay, so my what I learned even from yesterday is one of the reasons Carson would stay in the race is he continues to get time on the radio, TV. The other factor is that Rubio is not going to be running again for another seat in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So if Rubio stays in it, and Rubio is telling us that he still feels that once we get to the Midwest and once we get north of the beltways and things, that his chances are stronger, that then Carson would then be somebody that would be strongly considered mm-hmm. to take the Senate seat for Florida.
So he's just playing this now to be a senator at this point. He knows he's not going to win the presidency, right?
That's what the gist was of what I heard yesterday. It did make sense.
Yeah.
Something that I never considered before.
Well, but I think I'm trying to see. I think the candidates are up and running already in Florida, and Rubio's not running, so that seat's open either way.
Right, right. Oh, I agree with you. But then Carson would then, you know, he's shown he's been very strong to show people that he is an intelligent person, and he would then properly represent the people of Florida as a senator.
Is it worth the effort, Steve, for him to go through these paces just for a Senate seat? I mean, I know it's important to be a senator, but is it worth it to be in this sort of steamer just to be the senator?
Honestly, he's the one. I just told you, Kasich's strategy. He still has a strategy. It might be a failed one, but he has a plan. I don't see Carson's plan. I don't understand it unless, you know, as Kevin said, he's trying to keep his name out there. You know,
maybe.
He's a very, very successful author.
Right.
You know, maybe he's trying to continue the brand. I don't know.
And here's an intelligent, here I am as an intelligent person, that if you want proper senatorial representation for the state of Florida, here I am.
Yes, but
you mean for Ben Carson, you're saying?
Correct. Sorry.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Correct. The other thing with Rubio is Rubio does still really, I watched him a lot last night. He really still does believe, you know, once we get into the Midwest and once we get into the areas that are not necessarily the Bible Belt, you know, areas, that he will perform better. And he still believes that he can ultimately defeat, you know, the Democratic side.
But the math just doesn't add up. It just does. It just doesn't.
Bill, I know you're a mathematician, so I'm gonna follow that. But you guys are great. Thank you very much for taking
Kevin.
The call.
Thanks, Kevin. Could Ben Carson be, I don't even know if this is a position, Steve, you tell me, the Secretary of Gentleness? Is there a Secretary of Gentleness?
How about a hand model?
Ben Carson.
Hand model.
A hand model?
Yeah,
oh, did you see that story yesterday?
About Trump's little hands?
No.
That one?
No.
That was John Oliver saying he has little fingers.
No, but
he was
Rubio
accused.
Rubio then put that on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
Oh.
He says he's 6'2". Yeah. He said, but he's got little hands. He goes, and you know what they say about guys with little hands?
Right.
You can't trust them.
Right.
That is just ridiculous. Look what this has come to.
Right. And then yesterday or the day before, Trump's like, I'm 6'3", not 6'2". And I don't know. I think I got pretty big hands.
That's His hands aren't big.
Anyway, yesterday in Wisconsin, Scott Walker was signing, I think, 58 bills.
Mm-hmm.
And before he started to sign them, you know, he tweeted out a picture of his hand. He took a picture of his hand.
Yeah. That's
awesome.
It? No.
He took a picture of his hand, and he goes, this is my hand before I signed 58 bills.
Is that funny?
And that just took off.
You
know, people
beautiful.
Were, you know, this is my hand before I punch you in the face. And, you know, people just kept retweeting it and building on it.
Let me see your hands, Bill.
I got human-sized hands.
Yeah, you do.
I got human-sized.
I have man hands.
Yeah, yeah. They're nice. Nice man hands. All right, a break, more show. Jump in, would you? 312-981-7200. That's our phone number and our text line. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN. All right, we're just kind of recapping everything that happened, or some of what happened last night. A lot of things happened last night. I don't think any major surprises, but if you want to jump in, you can at 312-981-7200.
Hey, PJ.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. You had some thoughts about last night?
Well, yeah, my question is you know, Trump ends up, God forbid, you know, winning, getting the nomination by the primaries. When he gets to the convention, do do they have to give it to him, or can they, you know?
All right, Steve, jump in on this at any point, but here's what was discussed last night, because I was monitoring this on CNN, and I switched around a little bit, but CNN addressed exactly this.
God, you're a junkie.
I border on that. All right, so last night, that exact same question came up. What if he is the guy, as far as the party's concerned, and then it comes to the convention, the Republican convention, and the heads of the Republicans decide this is not in our best interest? And the name Paul Ryan came up last night, Steve, and one or two other names came up, but Paul Ryan seemed to be the one that, if they were in panic mode, they might give the nod to. But then it was decided by all panelists, every one of them said this would be party suicide, that if it came to that and they picked a guy that wasn't the guy that has gone all through the process, that would be the way of saying to America,
we're backing
imploding.
Our guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And I don't know that they can do that without, I mean, you know, if Trump, I think the delegates are obligated to vote on the first ballot. Did they talk about that, Bill?
They didn't talk about
that.
So
if Trump goes into the convention with the majority of delegates, which right now it looks like he will,
yeah,
I don't think there's anything that they can do by rule. If he doesn't have the majority, you know, then it's an open convention and they can, you know, there hasn't been an uncertain Republican convention, I think, since 1976 with Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan.
They brought that up, actually.
Did they? Yeah.
They did.
So, yeah, well, it'd be difficult if you had a guy who had an overwhelming plurality of the delegates.
As Trump does.
As Trump will, yeah, and then not get the nomination.
Yeah, you can't just bring in someone else,
well,
can you?
Well, it's their party.
But that would just look completely crazy. That's like, why go through the process?
You mean
then?
Like nominating a guy who wants to commit war crimes and...
Something,
you know,
like that, yeah.
I mean, the guy's campaigning on the fact that he wants to kill terrorists' families.
I know, I'm shocked at that. Someone else has texted in a good idea. I think we know, I think Trump's VP has been decided, Chris Christie endorsement and on the campaign trail. That's interesting.
It is.
Because Chris Christie,
I
you know.
I wonder.
Is that why he's endorsing him? Hey, you got room for me and your small hands? My hands are normal.
I wonder.
If we could work together, yin and yang.
It's hard to put together that's why he's doing it, but.
It makes some sense.
It does make a little. If anything makes sense,
right,
in any of
thing.
This.
Something has to make sense, so maybe it's that, but. I mean, there has to be a reason.
Let me ask you guys this. Yesterday, during Jake Tapper's
I love him,
conversation,
by the way.
He does a nice job.
He really does.
All right, so it was Jake Tapper, and he's talking to Marco Rubio, and he alluded to the fact that he wonders if he might be a little bit delusional at some point. Marco Rubio, not once but twice, referred to the, and I've heard this before. It's not the first time I've heard this referred to, but he wants to restore the Republican Party. It is the party of Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan. Aren't you dipping a little deep into the history books? Abraham Lincoln was a fantastic president, no doubt about it. But when you have to go back that far to find your second powerful president, Ronald Reagan is all within our memory. But Abraham Lincoln goes back quite a ways.
Yeah, but he's made a big name for himself. That's a good name
has.
To bring up. I'm
no,
sorry.
I mean, he's nearly
on the penny.
He's
for
nearly
God's
like founding father.
Yeah.
Even I mean, you know, he could point to Eisenhower. He could point to others. But
yeah, there's been other great Republican presidents.
But Lincoln.
Lincoln is Lincoln.
Wins. He's
all right.
The top. Runner.
All right. It just as I'm watching, I'm going, boy, you're pulling out a deep history book on that. I agree with you. Abraham Lincoln is a great role model for the party, but. There's been a couple of other recent guys you could probably mention, maybe.
Yeah, but that's your go-to guy.
I know. All right. I'll give it to him.
I've been showing you CNN political analysts all morning because you forgot to bring in the name. Is that her?
No, that is not. They really, there is no shortage of political analysts on any of the cable stations. They were just, I mean.
Was it Gloria Borger?
No, I just
that's the
showed
one,
him
that's
that.
That's the one that Wendy's showing me.
An SE Cup.
It was not also. It was not.
Who knew there was another SE Cup?
Right. SE Cup was Irv Cups and its wife.
What would Irv have to say about that?
That's right.
Different spelling. One's initials.
Right.
And yeah. All right. Finally, we have one more caller. Hi, Chris. Is this Chris Christie?
No, it's not. No, I'm not the future vice president either. So what I think is funny is the more discussion that we have about Donald Trump only gives those people that are just rabid fans of his more credibility. I can't see any way that he could possibly be elected president, possibly getting the nomination, almost definitely getting the nomination, but there's just no way. I don't see how he can get the minority vote. I don't see how he can get the women's vote.
What were you saying about him?
That's what put people over the top, and there's no way.
What were you saying about him last June and in July? Because almost all of us...
That you couldn't even win the nomination.
Yeah, myself included, said there's no way he could ever win the nomination.
Yeah, but I agree with Chris. When it all comes down to it, there's no way he is going to become president of the United States. Mark my words, on this date, March 2nd, 2016, in the year of our...
Okay, I dare you to cross this line. Okay, now I dare you to cross this line.
I agree with you, Chris. When push comes to shove and the election actually happens...
But when it comes down to two people, I mean, in the early days when the Republicans just had this huge parade of potential candidates, you go, well, he's not going to beat a field of 16 people, but now he has.
He's not going to beat Hillary.
But in the Republican Party right now, there is no consensus anywhere. So it made it very easy for somebody to step in who consistently gets 28 to 30% of the vote to continue to capture that vote. That's a very easy thing to do when there's nobody else out there that can build any consensus. So he will continue to get his 30%, and then the rest will fall out during the election. And I'm very confident that I won't have to check on my Canadian citizenship status because I know he's going to lose.
Senator Cruz on the line.
No, Chris, why don't you hang on the line? Kevin, I want you to get Chris's number because we're going to go out and have a cocktail when he doesn't win after the election.
Bill, you play tennis, right?
Yes.
And so when you're playing tennis, it's good to know your opponent, which way your opponent's likely to move, how he plays.
Sure.
Donald Trump doesn't play by any sort of form.
Right.
It's going to be a completely different sort of general election. He's going to be completely unpredictable like he's been in the primary.
No. He's not going to win.
Well, I'm not predicting he's going to win. I'm just saying I wouldn't predict he's not.
The danger right now is that he's totally polarizing this country. He's polarizing the races. He's polarizing all ethnic backgrounds. He's polarizing everybody, and it's not healthy, and people need to see through this. They need to wake up and smell the coffee. I'm not saying that Hillary is the best person out there to be president, but I'm saying she's a much better alternative than what the Republicans are offering right now.
When's Election Day? November what?
I don't know.
Steve, don't know. Do you know the exact...
It's in the single digits.
All right, we'll call back after he has not won, Chris, and we'll celebrate you and me.
Party on.
Chris, thank you.
You and I. I never know which one to do.
Everybody
involved. I've got words. I got big words. I can't even figure which to use, you, me, or I.
There's too many words. There's too many. We'll take a quick break. Steve has the news and then a lot more show. Comedian Jimmy Pardo joining us in just a little bit. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thanks so much. It's Bill Effen. It's Wendy Snyder. Jimmy Pardo's on the line. I don't think any introduction that you or I give Jimmy is up to snuff. He's just so good. Jimmy, can you give yourself an introduction? Would you mind?
I'm not comfortable doing that. I think that is your responsibility as a broadcaster, but I appreciate you throwing it back at me.
Why don't you introduce us?
Yeah, introduce Wendy and me.
All right, here's two guys that I can't believe are still on the air, Bill and Wendy.
That's hurtful. I don't know why you...
I like it.
That's hurtful.
You're funny.
Guys, I'm just following the Republican landscape where you lash out negatively when you have nothing of value to say.
Do you have small hands, Jimmy Pardo? You have small hands,
I'm a small man with small hands. I think they're proportionate.
Yeah, because if he was a small man with big hands, that would look weird.
Freakish.
Oh, my God, would that look... Yeah, it would look freakish. I'd be in a circus traveling the world.
But stop for a minute and think about that. Would that be the worst thing in the world?
I don't know. Is it any different than what we did in the late 80s of touring the
country?
Stand-up
comedy? No, same thing. Same exact thing.
Did you have a perm, too?
I'm sorry, Wendy?
Did you have a perm, too, in the 80s like Bill did?
Did I? Let me tell you something. If you watch Conan O'Brien tonight, there's a chance that I will show a picture of one of my first headshots. And it's awful.
You did have a little bit of a perm.
Everybody had a perm.
Sometimes we called it a body wave, so it didn't sound feminine, but it was a perm.
My hair was naturally curly, and I fought that for years. And then finally in the 80s, because it was, you know, the permanent, your body wave were very acceptable.
Right.
I just let it go and looked, I'm going to say ridiculous, but that's the word I want to use.
But what Wendy fails to realize, Jimmy, and you'll remember this, is when you and I were on the Brady Bunch, they came to us one year and they said, you guys are all getting perms. All the boys on the show were getting perms. So we had no say in it.
Well, we do. When the network has control like that, Bill, you're exactly right. When you have to understand that, we're talking networks now. You understand?
Yep. ABC.
So when the network comes to you and says it's perm day, it's perm day.
Right. Mike Lookinland, Bobby, is the one who fought it. And Jimmy and I are like, don't fight it, Mike. We're all going to get perms.
Were you wearing glasses in this particular picture with your curly mullet?
I'm going to ask you to please not put that up on the internet as to not.
It's already on the internet.
I'm a quick Googler. I will not put it up until you blast it out. But right. Oh, my God.
Look how everything about, and I'm going to talk about it tonight. I don't want to sound like I got one trick and I have one story to tell. But everything's wrong with that picture. There's not a single thing right with it.
I love you even more, Jimmy.
It shows vulnerability, is what it shows.
Well, I don't know what it was showing at the time. Error, waste of money. Everything about that thing is wrong. What a jerk.
Oh, come on. Jimmy, when you're doing a network spot like Conan, and you said you're doing it tonight, do you get a little nervous that day? What does that day bring to you?
You know what? It's interesting. The first couple times I was obviously nervous because it was something I never, you know, I'd done panel on, you know, like local news or local like AM Omaha type of things.
Yeah.
But to go on, you know, on Conan to do panel, I had never done it on that, you know, on that level. And, you know, I also at the time I worked at Conan every day. So when I went on to panel, if it stunk, I got to come to work the next
day. Sure.
Yep. And, you know, and hope to not avoid eye contact until we all realize I should quit. but luckily it went great, and now it's fun. So now it's, you know, Conan and I have this great, you know, I hate to make this comparison. Other people have. I'll just quote them. We have a great, you know, Rickles, Johnny Carson vibe whenever I'm on.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get to go back and forth with each other. I think it's a lot more loose and a lot more fun than just your standard scripted interview.
You can tell that he appreciates you and he enjoys you, and that makes for a good segment or two.
A good viewing segment.
I think so, too. You know, Bill Burr's the same way. Norm MacDonald, again, I'm not comparing myself to them, but there are certain guests that go on there, and it's just, you know, Tom Hanks, Ricky Gervais even.
Are you comparing yourself to Tom Hanks and Ricky Gervais?
That for sure.
Well, I don't know if you know this about Ricky Gervais. He's an atheist. He never brings it up.
Right.
Every other sentence he brings it up. I am comparing myself to Tom Hanks. I do believe I'm one of the best actors in Hollywood, yes.
All right.
A listener just called and wanted us to ask you about a Jack Lemmon story.
No, I have no Jack Lemmon stories.
Make one up.
Oh, okay. Oh, that Jack Lemmon story. I was sitting on a park bench once.
Wait a minute. This is so odd. This has never happened, Jimmy. Somebody went out of their way to dial us up to say, if you're talking to Jimmy Pardo, there's one thing you must do, and that's ask him about Jack Lemmon. But you say there's nothing between you and Jack Lemmon.
I want to know what.
What about
call back, listener? Maybe they thought you were Don Pardo or Tom Hanks.
What about Chet Lemon? Do you have a story about Chet Lemon?
wait, what'd you say, Bill?
What about Chet Lemon, former White Sox center fielder? Do you have a story about him?
You know what? I just did an interview where I did bring up Chet Lemon quite a bit. That's actually true.
All right,
good old number 44.
Wow, nice.
I don't have a Jack Lemmon story. I want to know, did he get the person wrong?
I don't know. I think he might be calling back. Can I tell you, like, how this is almost like a psychic interview? I mentioned something about the 80s and your perm and if you had one, and then that came up, and now, like, this whole Jack Lemmon, Chet Lemmon. You really just mentioned Chet Lemmon recently?
I mentioned him on a podcast called the Shack Box. I just did it where it's about baseball cards, but the baseball cards then lead you about your life. It's pretty cool.
All right, stand by. We have this listener with the Jack Lemmon situation. John, Jimmy, John. Jimmy Johns, freaky fast.
My name is John Tamburino.
Oh, hey, John.
Hi, John.
Tamburino.
Yeah, we got it, John.
The 1987 WGN Comedy Laugh Off.
That's right.
John, this is my segment, John. Get off.
You can have it. Do you remember when I used to tell you that all the time? You're going to grow up and do the Jack Lemmon story. I go, you are the next Jack Lemmon. You are one of the best actors in Hollywood. You are the next Jack Lemmon. Why don't you do his story?
First of all, John, this is not my story. It sounds like it's your story.
I tell you that all the time.
But, Jimmy,
I'm literally a prop in this story. That's all I am.
Jimmy, all things being equal, you get a call tomorrow morning from one of the big movie studios, and they say, Jimmy, we're making the Jack Lemmon story, and you're at the top of our list. Do you make that movie or not?
I say, I'm going to ask you a question. Did you confirm this with 1987 WGN Comedy Bowl winner John Tamburino? And if they say, yes, we did, I will agree to the part, yes.
All right.
All right, hang on.
John, thank you.
Hey, Bill.
Back to you, Jimmy.
Wait, hang on. Can I just say this? In all seriousness, I have not seen John Tamborino in 20 years. How funny was John Tamborino, Bill?
I remember him, too.
Do you remember John?
Yes.
One of the funniest comics our city's ever produced.
Totally. And I always bring up my friend Carla Felicia, who did stand-up, and I saw all you guys back in the 80s.
Right, right.
It was, what a joy. That was fun, huh? That was fun, a little memory lane with John Tamborino.
John made a conscious decision, Jimmy, years ago. He was going to lay low in the weeds until you came on the show and then bring up the Jack Lemmon story, and it paid off.
So ridiculous. And when we have John on next week, you call in to, take over his interview.
Right.
You know what I do then? I go, hey, John, I call in and say, you got to ask John about the pancakes.
Right.
And then I call in and go, yeah, remember the time we had breakfast and I had pancakes, John? That's the same story. There's no difference.
All right.
That's so ridiculous. All right. Can you hang on? We're going to take a quick break and come back, and we'll talk about your 7th annual podcast-a-thon and, of course, Never Not Funny, your podcast.
I will wait patiently. Thank you.
More with Jimmy Pardo, our generation's Jack Lemmon, in just a moment. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Jimmy Pardo's our guest, comedian, actor, writer, podcast genius. His podcast, Never Not Funny, is one of the most successful in all the internet. He is about to celebrate his 7th annual podcast-a-thon this upcoming Saturday, and it benefits Smile Train. What do we need to know about this, Jimmy?
Bill, their central time, it goes from 2 p.m. to 2 a.m. It's the 12-hour version of the aforementioned Never Not Funny podcast. Myself, along with Matt Belknap and Pat Francis, we host the whole 12 hours. We have a different guest on every 25 minutes. People in the past that have stopped by have been like Conan O'Brien, John Hamm, Amy Poehler, Fred Willard, Weird Al Yankovic, Sarah Silverman. Great people like that will stop by and donate their time. We are raising money for Smile Train, the great organization that goes to third world countries and performs the surgery to fix the cleft palates for children and adults that can't otherwise afford it. Each surgery only costs $250 and only takes 45 minutes. So basically, if you donate $250, you are changing a child's life.
All right. I've known you for a long time, and I know the time and effort you put into this, but I don't know why you chose that particular affliction. Is there a reason?
You know what? I saw the ad on the back of Parade magazine about 7 years ago, and it was just a perfect storm of things where, I was talking with Pat Francis and Matt the next day, and it turned out like we all had donated money the day before to Smile Train because we all saw that ad. There's something about seeing the ad where you see the before and after of the child.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, wow, for $250, I can change that kid's life, and it made sense to me. And so we did a small little contest to raise money for them at first, and then it turned it into this podcast-a-thon, a telethon-style show where people can donate. You can go to nevernotfunny.com, and there's a button on there to, click and donate money. And, the first year we raised $13,000, and then last year we raised $150,000.
Wow.
So
that's impressive.
It's grown, and, I know it sounds maudlin and cliche, but it really does change a kid's life, and it's life-changing to, provide that kind of help.
You're a good man, Jimmy Pardo.
I do the best I can, Wendy. Try to get through it every day like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a text here and says, Jimmy Pardo's Alan Arkin impersonation is funny. You should ask him about it.
Is that one true or not true?
I'm just curious. Are they going to hit the entire cast of Glengarry Glen Ross? Is that what's going to happen? I do not do an Arkin. That is not my... No, I can't take any credit for an Arkin.
Jimmy, we've never had a guest on the show. Wendy and I have been doing the show for years. We've never had a guest with more mismatched texts to the guest than today. You broke a record today.
Well, it's a record that I hope stands. I'll tell you that. I don't want to be Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa battling out, and then one of them doesn't get it. I don't even understand that comparison, what I just made.
Another text just says that you sound like Jack Lemmon.
You know what? I hear that quite a bit. My dad's wife says that quite a bit. My dad's wife, Donna. Jim Pardo is my daddy. Lives right there in Westmont.
Hey, Jim.
Give the address, Jimmy. Would you mind giving the address?
I'm not comfortable doing that. I probably shouldn't have even said the city now they say that. My brother Mike also lives in Westmont. The whole family's in Westmont.
Are they in Westmont? Well, that happens eventually. Families will migrate out to Westmont. They like what they see,
sure.
And they live
there's
there.
There's a Hobby Lobby there. What more can you like? And a White Castle. I mean, really? That's
it's
awesome.
It's 6 minutes from Downers Grove. Are you kidding me?
Oh, right. You got a direct line, right? Just use Main Street right there, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, you could take Ogden Avenue. There's so many ways. I mean, it's fantastic.
Really, you go north and south on either of those, right, Bill?
Yep. It's easy to do. Easy to find. Absolutely.
Sure.
We know what a huge White Sox fan you are, Jimmy. Should we be optimistic about the 2016 Chicago White Sox?
I feel good about it. Do I think they should have signed one of the free agent right fielders, or even a Nian Desmond, who now is going to play left field for the Rangers? Should they have signed him to play right? Maybe. Had they made one of those moves, and Austin Jackson's still out there, Rick Hahn, if you're listening, apparently you can't see that name on a piece of paper. I can. Dexter Fowler would have been a nice addition.
Signed by the
I
Cubs.
Think if they would have done that, I'd feel great about the White Sox. As it stands, I feel very, very good about them. And, boy, that was not a bad Trump impression I just did.
That was a great Trump impression.
I hear you do a great Trump impression.
Oh, thank you so much. We finally got to the guy that I do. Thank you.
Oh, you don't want to do him. He has small hands.
What if that's all I did? I was a hand model for Donald Trump.
Well, this if there's,
Trump.
If there's ever been a time to have that job, Jimmy, this would be it right now.
Well, it sounds like maybe even in the next 8 years, Bill. Holy smokes.
I know.
I don't know if you guys go political on the program. I don't mean to bring it down that path, but if we go that path, oh, the White Sox are the least of our worries, Bill.
They need Ozzy back. Got to bring back Ozzy Guillen.
Oh, Wendy, stop with
no!
that nonsense. We don't need that virus in the clubhouse.
Shame on you.
He won once. You could have managed that team to a win.
No way.
Jimmy, Trump said yesterday he would build a wall around Ozzy Guillen. Do you think that's a good idea? I don't think that's a good idea.
That's the first right thing he said. I'd like a nice wall around him. I would adapt some Bostonian terms. I would call that the Green Monster. And then just yell to Ozzy I would send stuff down in a bucket.
Speaking of sports and walls, NASCAR has now endorsed Donald Trump.
Right.
So if around his wall that he wants to build, why don't they put a racetrack, and that would be like the moat to get to the wall? How good is that?
That's a good idea. And, Jimmy, someone's texting in saying you do a great Dale Earnhardt impression. Can we hear that?
Oh, my God.
Junior or senior?
Senior.
Senior, of course.
Right.
That's your impression. It's quiet. He's dead.
That's right. That's why I do a very good one.
Oh, my God.
He would just I know for a fact he would just always go, on your left. On your left.
Yep. Yep.
That's what he would do.
Very caring. Very caring human being.
Very caring racer.
Jimmy, we're so happy for you. The 7th annual podcastathon, hard to say the first time, easy to say the second time. The 7th annual podcastathon is coming up this Saturday. It runs from 2 a.m. to 2 p.m. or the other way around?
Flip-flop that.
2 p.m. to 2 a.m. 12 straight hours of all kinds of important fun with Jimmy Pardo. And then Never Not Funny is the website, nevernotfunny.com, if you want to hear the regular podcasts as well. Good luck on Saturday.
Thank you, guys, and thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you.
You as well. Work on that, Jack Lemmon.
Please, by next time, Jimmy, if you could do a scene from The Apartment for us, that'd be fantastic.
More than happy to. I've already got the in-laws memorized. We'll do it.
Would you do Wendy and me a favor, and that's at some point on your Conan appearance today, just start blinking for no reason, and we'll know you're saying hello to us.
All right, that'll let you know. That'll be my signal too. Or I'll just go, hey, Bill and Wendy. I can do that too.
All right.
We'll be looking for your wonderful picture from way back when.
Good Lord. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jimmy. John Tamburino is going to call in during Conan today, so be ready
for
that.
No, he's just going to show up on set. He'll come and ask you to get out of the chair.
How great would that be? Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks. And by the way, didn't you want Jim Tamburino to call back and give his number to Kevin?
If you're still listening,
Jimmy, Johnny.
Call and give us your number. I would love to talk to him. One of the best comics I ever worked with, ever. All right. A quick break, and then more show. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
All right. We have Dr. John Duffy in the studio, highly sought after clinical psychologist and you're a parenting and relationship expert, a certified life coach, best-selling author of the book The Available Parent. Everyone tries to be a good parent, and yet we can all learn something. So welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What would you like to focus on today?
You know, one thing that I've noticed in my practice in the last few weeks, probably the last couple of months or so, is there's this divide. I get these kids, probably half my referrals are from kids coming from this high pressure atmosphere, and they're buckling under the pressure of doing really, really, really well under all these demands and all these activities and all this academic pressure. And on the other side of the spectrum are kids who look lazy, seem like they're opting out of virtually everything, and yet they both end up in the same place in my office. And there's both, in both cases, there's a powerful degree of stress involved. It just manifests in completely different ways. I think it's really tough for parents to get like, oh yeah, even my kid that's lazy or appears lazy is pretty stressed out as
right.
well. Yeah.
John, what has happened? That stress has always existed. Kids in grade school are under stress to do good, to get into high school. Kids in high school are under stress to get into college. And then the cycle just continues. Why aren't we handling it better? What has changed?
Way more work.
It's a great question. I've wondered that. It's way more work. It is. The kids have way more work. There are more millennials, right? So there are more younger kids now than there were when we were kids. And so there's more competition too.
Oh.
More competitions to get on teams, more competitions to get to the top of the class. There's there's more work for sure, Wendy, and there is more competition. And so, you know, like, and parents from early on, we all kind of know this, have their eye on college, right? Like, you know,
right.
Okay, how am I going to position my kid to get into the very best college they can? And we're thinking about this, you know, a decade before our parents thought about it, if they thought about it at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're also more attentive to it, but way more work is way up on the list for sure.
But is this, I know competition in some respects is healthy, but is it, it's now beyond healthy, isn't it?
I think for a lot of kids, it gets to the point where it is no longer healthy. I was talking to a dad the other day whose kid is a pitcher, and he's in eighth grade, and he's an ace. He's unbelievable. He's really, really good. But he's about to go to a high school where the freshman class has 1,000 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple hundred of those boys are going to want to be on that baseball team. So his odds of making the team, his main skill in life, are real slim. And then he's got to find something else to be his mission, you know?
But isn't that good training for the way life is? Because that's how life is.
It is. But man, that's an awful early way to learn the lesson.
Yeah.
And you don't really have the resilience. You know, I think we like to think we can build our resilience slowly and our competence slowly over time. That's why we create these a dozen years of school, you know, so we can kind of ease our way into it.
Right.
But I feel like our kids are right in the frying pan right away, sometimes in grade school, certainly by middle school.
We had a documentarian on, was it last week, I think, Ted Dintersmith, and he's put together this documentary, Most Likely to Succeed. It debuted at Sundance. It's going to be at South by Southwest on March 10th. And he was talking about the way school is. It's based on back in the 1800s where you just sat in a classroom and you just you memorized all these things and facts. But they're trying to change it so it's more hands-on.
Right.
And he has been contacted, what did he say, by like 200 schools after this debuted at Sundance. And Bill raised the question, there are some students who want the typical let's do it and memorize these things.
Absolutely.
But this is on a volunteer basis. So there are some teachers that want to experiment with this and some students. And what a great idea, because people learn differently.
Great idea. You know, that's one thing I think we do a poor job of is like, you know, we expect that, you know, we come up with this model.
Cookie cutter mold.
Right. All kids are going to respond in the same way. Never really bears itself out. And some kids who are really, really bright in a lot of different ways just don't master the conventional way. And it looks like, oh, they're not that bright. So they need some kind of special plan. When in fact, if we were a little more flexible in the way we teach kids, we could probably find a way of learning that works for every kid.
Are you a fan of Montessori schools?
I like Montessori schools. Yeah, I think that's a good way to start. I think it teaches some flexibility in thinking early on, you know, and that's a big part of learning, like, oh, I'm a competent, resilient person. I can handle different stressors and situations. So, yeah, I actually like that way of starting. And if that model carried itself through even public schools in some way, I don't think you can do Montessori all the way through. I think that's really tricky. But in some way, if there was a little more flexibility in the education system, I think we could find success for every kid because every kid has strengths. It isn't always the apparent, like, you know, I'm really, really good at algebra.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And you talked about a friend of yours who got their child got a perfect ACT score or SAT and was straight A student and couldn't get into a certain college because wasn't the right student. They're looking for a diversified type of curriculum and education and group of people. So, I mean, do grades matter as much as we think they do?
I'm going to say no. I also think finding that, you know, very, very best college doesn't necessarily matter as much as we think it does. I think we're always, instead of looking for the highest echelon, the more we look for goodness of fit. You know, this suits my child really, really well, right? And he or she is in, at the very least, probably the top half of this class, so they're going to have a good go at it. Instead of going, like, I'm going to struggle to get into Princeton, but it's going to be really, really brutal for those 4 years that I'm there because I just barely made it in, and I'm used to being at the top of my high school class, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean,
to really learn more at a great top at college, or do you learn well where you fit in? Is it just the name? Oh, I went to Princeton. But you could go somewhere else to a smaller college, but still have learned the same, if not more.
You're definitely hitting on something, that a nerve of mine, because there's some great research out there that suggests you find goodness of fit, you're going to learn everything you need to know, and you're more likely probably to stay in the career you want to be in. Sometimes you get into that top-tier school, and you realize, well, I wanted to be an engineering major, but this is just too hard, so I'm going to opt for something that's less than optimal for me, not what
right.
I want to do.
Right. Yeah. Let's take a quick break. Dr. John Duffy is here. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach us at 312-981-7200. That's the call line and the text line. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
We're talking with Dr. John Duffy. Someone just texted and said that they read The Available Parent. It's a number one best-selling book, and she said it changed their lives.
Well, how nice is that? Thank you very much.
Or he. I don't really know because it was a text message. You know, last time you were here, we didn't get to talk about something, and I don't know if we're going to have time to talk about it today either, because we have some more questions, but how to find the right therapist or psychologist.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind, but okay. We do have some questions from the listeners. Matt is on the line. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment to the doctor about what he was talking about earlier with finding the right fit.
College-wise, you mean?
No. College.
Oh, okay.
College. Excuse me.
That's all right.
I went to a college for a semester and a half, and before I went in, I thought, oh, man, this is going to be great. And it was a really big one. It was Ball State University. And I ended up coming home because it just wasn't a good fit. Ended up going to North Central College, and I loved it. Absolutely the greatest program over there for their exercise science department.
There you have it.
That's actually a great story, Matt. It actually points to another important factor when it comes to the whole college decision. We think that that first decision is terminal. Boy, we're stuck with it, and there's this extra load of pressure on making that decision. But sometimes if you find, okay, this one doesn't work out perfectly well, you can make an adjustment and find the right thing. And, you know, with a semester and a half at Ball State, you probably realized, okay, this just doesn't work for me. I'm going to find a better fit.
Exactly. It was fantastic. And now I love what I do. I'm in the career that I'm going to be in for the rest of my life.
Good for you, Matt. That's awesome.
That ended nice.
I went to Illinois State because when it was time to go to college, my mom just said, where are you going to college? Not, are you going to college? What do you want to do? I knew I wanted to be in radio in junior high. I wanted to find the quickest way to get there. I only made it a little over a semester there because I hated it. I couldn't cut the apron strings. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be away from home. Mm-hmm. Came back, went to Triton College, and loved it.
So there are a whole bunch of different avenues that can work, right? You know, I think sometimes in our generation, our kids' generation, they think, like, if this one school doesn't happen, it's a complete failure. When, in fact, there are a whole bunch of different ways to get where you want to go if you're really creative about it. So, you know, like, that's a really good story. And I think some people might say, oh, that wouldn't work or that wouldn't apply today. I tend to disagree with that. I think you could have made that work today, you know?
And Bill, one of your daughters wanted to take a gap year, which until I heard you talk about it, I just thought that meant working at the Gap to make money for college.
Sure.
But a lot of kids are doing this where they go away and do things of value.
I never heard of it ever. And then it was presented to me. Kylie said, I'm really considering this. And here's what was in my head. If I took a gap year between high school and college, I don't think I would have gone to college. I would have said, there's too much great stuff out there to enjoy.
Spoken like a true parent.
I mean it. I wouldn't have gone back. But right. she's done some very worthwhile things. She's traveled, and she can't wait to start school in the fall. So I guess it can work.
Everyone's different.
And it's a really cool thing, like more and more these days. 5 years ago, I hadn't really heard of a gap year either. I probably would have thought it was working at the Gap like you, Wendy. But more kids that I'm working with are taking a gap year where they just feel like I'm not either prepared to go to college or I want some different experience right now when I'm this age. And not only is it great experience, it sounds like your daughter had great experience, but also it makes you more marketable to colleges that you might not have gotten into a year ago.
That's
so there's
exactly
a whole
what
bunch
she's
of good
going
benefits.
Through now. Yeah. They're looking at that on her transcript or her resume, and they're impressed by it.
Yeah, so. Suddenly she's a really interesting candidate, right?
Again,
yeah.
More than grades and SAT scores, right?
Way more than grades, right?
You know, on that same topic, really quickly, one of the colleges she's applied for has said to her by way of email, we respect the grades, but the grades aren't our main concern. They had to write a series of essays. They gave her a bunch of essay questions, and they said, that's primarily what we're looking for, is a well-rounded person. If you have good grades, that's a nice bonus, but that's not their major factor in deciding who's going to their school. I like that.
Yeah, I think we miss the boat sometimes, and we're guessing what college admissions counselors are interested in. I went to a conference of admissions counselors a few years ago, and I asked them, you know, so I work with a lot of kids who are on their way to college. What are you guys looking for? And the overriding thought was, don't bore us. Don't bore us because
like
we see the same thing over and over again. Right. So tell me an interesting story, you know, so your daughter has an interesting story to tell.
Yeah.
And that's probably way more compelling than, okay, another kid that got a 4.0 GPA.
Right.
I've seen that before.
Yeah.
And we heard from this Ted Dintersmith, again, this documentarian most likely to succeed is the documentary. He mentioned starting next year. So for kids that are juniors and going away to college next year, there is going to be a new admission process where you do it online and you upload videos or things. So it's not even written essays as much anymore. And 90 colleges, I believe he said, are accepting that.
Yeah.
So that is good news. And Mary actually had a college admission question.
Hi. Yeah, I did. Of course, I'm about to pick up my preschooler, too. So
you don't have to start worrying about college now.
No, I have both. I have a high school junior and a preschooler. So my question is, obviously, the one that's going off to college is the oldest of our six kids. So paying for college is going to be a big challenge. But also, he has an opportunity, and this is what I really wanted to ask Dr. John Duffy about. He caddies. He's been caddying for the past 3 years. But now he has an opportunity to do an internship at an engineering firm downtown for this summer. And I'm just wondering which you think is probably going to look, I don't want to say look better, but which do you think is more beneficial? The opportunity to continue caddying and apply for the Evans Scholarship, or to sort of go outside the box and to look at this chance to, you know, I'm telling him, I think he's kind of young to be trained to work at an engineering firm. He's got his whole life to work inside behind a desk.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Mary. I get your point. I suppose the answer that if he were sitting across from me, what I would want to know from your son is, what do you want to do? What are you most interested in, and why? And that might drive the right answer. I tend to agree with you, though. It might be a little premature to work in an internship at an engineering firm. Not that it wouldn't look impressive on a resume, but if he had a good reason for caddying, admissions counselors, they read those letters that you write. And so, you know, if he had a good reason for making that choice, just the choice alone of choosing caddying over an engineering internship might be compelling. So I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer to that. I think he almost has to follow his gut and have a good reason for making the decision he makes.
Yeah, I tell you, it is really hard. It's a lot different than it was in 1989 when I was doing this. You know?
It is. You might not have needed either then.
And how weird is it to hear someone say, ask your kid what they want to do? Because for all these years, we never, as a kid, never had a chance to voice our opinion.
Right.
It's just a parent going, here's what you're doing.
Well, I think the more
the thing I'm learning. Oh, I'm sorry. What I'm learning with my littler kids, though, is that I do that more and more with my second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, and it's harder to cut that cord with the oldest, right? you know, you want everything perfect with your oldest.
That's true. And then you stop caring.
You experience the kids. Not stop caring.
I know, I'm kidding.
That, like, things are going to work out regardless. All right, well, thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mary. Good luck.
There's some engineering in caddying. I mean, there's a little bit of
that's true. There is
a little bit.
Right. Absolutely.
So
right.
Getting it both done.
You might do a hybrid of some kind.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. His name is Dr. John Duffy, and the book is really what every family should own if you have kids. And if not, you should teach like a parenting class in high schools. Because, you know, we were talking about this. There was consumer ed where you learned to balance a checkbook and things like that. But it's way harder than anyone anticipates being a parent.
I think that's true. And I think it's trickier now than it's ever been. There's so many variables. I know that some people feel like, well, is it really any tougher than it was a generation ago? And the truth of the matter is, it is. Academic pressure is a lot more powerful. The fear about drugs and alcohol, there's a whole slew of fears and anxieties that our parents just didn't suffer, you know, so they just kind of let us do our thing, whereas I think we feel this need to be a little more hands-on with our kids.
Sure.
Yeah.
Should we take a break and do some news?
Yeah.
And then do we want to find out how to find a good psychologist, a good therapist?
Yeah, sure.
Can you stick for after the news just
Absolutely.
To help us
We'd
with
love
that,
to.
And then
yep.
we'll let you be on your way.
Great.
His name's Dr. John Duffy, best-selling author, certified life coach, and clinical psychologist. And your website, if people want to get a hold of you?
DrJohnDuffy.com.
All right, 312-981-7200, Bill Leff, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. All right, mental health is something that everybody needs to talk about, and we have been talking about it. And yesterday when we were talking to one of the guys who was on stage with Lady Gaga, who was abused, all the abusers from the Oscars.
Kevin Kantner.
He said we have to talk about these things. We have to talk about mental illness. When Robin Williams passed away, it's like people are now talking about it more. So what do you do? How do you know who to see? Who to talk to? Do you need a psychologist? Do you need a psychiatrist? Dr. John Duffy hanging around to help us find out how you find someone.
Right. It can be really, really tricky. There are a lot of therapists in the Chicago area. So there's a couple of benchmarks I would encourage you to look at. Anybody who's looking for a therapist for themselves, for their children, you want to make sure that therapist has worked with the issue that you are struggling with. So, you know, and has some significant experience with that issue. So interviewing a therapist is a reasonable thing to do. A lot of people think like, well, I should just go in and sit down with them. But it's fair to say, well, I want to talk to you for a while on the phone and make sure that you have the experience that I'm looking for. And just as important, especially with kids, that you have some degree of goodness of fit. In other words, I have a feeling my kid is going to be able to connect with this person. So they don't come across as overly sterile or clinical, but they're a little more relaxed and they're a little more conversational, and they might have some idea about what video games are and what Instagram is. Because if you're clueless about that, you lose your credibility with kids in the first 10 minutes.
Didn't even think of that.
Oh, I would imagine that's very important. Now, you mentioned do that over the phone, but I would think it'd be more beneficial if you can to do that in person. Is that a possibility or not?
Absolutely a possibility. And I would prefer that. I would prefer to sit down with a parent for an hour and really talk through, tell me about your kid. Let's make sure that I'm a good match.
So before you bring the kid in, make an appointment for you, the parents?
Absolutely.
Yep. Really?
Yeah. I mean, because here's the thing about therapy and kids. You don't get many shots. So I've worked with a few kids where it's been like, okay, you're my third therapist that I've worked through. This is the last shot we're going to get, because I'll be done with the whole deal if this doesn't work. You know what I mean? So if you do a little prep work ahead of time and you realize, okay, this person seems personable, relatable, and not so clinical. They're not sitting there with a clipboard on their lap. I think my kid can relate to this person.
Yeah.
That is a big head start.
I know the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist is one can dispense medicine, the other cannot.
Correct.
How do you make that determination of whether you need one over the other?
Right. So if your kid is experiencing something that feels debilitating, really disruptive to his or her functioning, you might want to start with a psychiatrist. Short of that, I would start with a psychologist. Psychologists or licensed clinical social workers, any licensed therapist can be very qualified. I'd look at how long they've been practicing, but most of them are very qualified. And they can help you get a feel for whether you want to get a psychiatrist involved. So, you know, that's not a call I expect a parent to be able to make. There are professionals out there that you can rely on that know their business well enough to say, you know, like, yeah, I think we could use some medication to kind of help us through this. Or there's enough of a depression, anxiety, attention issue that we really need to get a psychiatrist involved.
Before I, we are neighbors, and before that I actually said, hey, will you see my kids? I had a lot of trouble trying to find therapists and doctors that would fit, and there aren't as many therapists who take children.
There are very few that take children, and I find that, you know, like I pay attention to who I refer to, because if people keep bouncing back, I realize, okay, this might not be the best referral source. So that's why I say, you know, like, rely on, you know, the mental health community to help you find a suitable therapist, because you're right, Wendy, it is really, really tricky. And somebody who says, oh, I work with kids all the time, that doesn't mean it always goes really well. So you want to make sure, that's why I like the idea of sitting down with somebody ahead of time, like you were saying, Bill, to get a feel for, you know, is this somebody my kid can relate to? And think about your kid. Think about this person and your kid. Picture them alone in the room. Will that conversation go well? And the first conversation and the second conversation are the most important ones.
Oh,
because,
I would imagine.
Right. If you lose those, you've lost that child.
But John, during that, I guess you call it an audition process with the parent, that's only part one. Then your child has to have a similar sit down with them as well to see if it's a good fit, right?
Absolutely right. And that also is kind of an audition process. So I would argue that a good therapist working with a kid, the initial session usually has very little to do with the issue that child is suffering or what they're doing wrong. Has a lot to do with what they're interested in, what they like to do, what they listen to, so that they feel like pretty good walking out of there and like, okay, I think I have an ally in this person.
Right.
This isn't just a mouthpiece for my mom and dad's issue with me. Yeah.
Forgive me for asking this, but I know people are thinking this. During that, again, audition process, would the customer be charged for that, or is that just how does that play out?
It depends therapist to therapist, but by and large, the customer would be charged for that.
Yeah.
I think most therapists would say, yeah, it's an hour of time, and we're probably going to charge that clinical
They're
hour.
They're not a drug dealer, for God's sakes. They don't give you your first part free.
Right.
Although mentioning drugs, and I had heard from another therapist that we used to see, that pretty soon psychologists are going to be able to dispense medication, that there was a new law passed. It's not happening now. I was telling Bill off the air, a psychiatrist, you know, you only see every 3 months. It's usually for really, you know, the first session is longer and they diagnose you. But then it's just kind of every 3 months, how you feel, everything good. Are you hearing voices?
Right.
No. Okay. Here's another 3 months of prescriptions.
Yes.
So the psychologist or the therapist is someone who actually gets deep down to know what's troubling the person.
Well, and that used to be the nature of psychiatry too. You know, if you go back 30, 40 years, psychiatrists used to serve both roles. So they would do therapy and then they would dispense medication where it indicated. And then in the Prozac era and since then, you know, I think psychiatry has just been such a money-making field that, you know, there's been such a focus there and less of a focus on the therapeutic end, and that's been left to therapists. So now, yes, my field, psychologists, are looking for these prescription privileges. So one thing that's clear is that the whole industry is in some degree of flux, and my hope is that at the back end of all of this, the right things happen. You know, I don't know that every psychologist should be prescribing medication, and I don't know that every psychiatrist should be doing therapy, but I hope that there's a balance that's struck in the long run so that everybody's needs get met appropriately.
Right.
Yeah.
Wendy mentioned it is at times hard to find a psychologist or a psychiatrist that deals with kids. Wouldn't you want a specialty? Wouldn't you want somebody who specializes in working with kids? That's to your advantage, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Yes. And that can be as simple as a Google search or looking at the APA, the American Psychological Association website, or the Psychology Today website, and they'll give you some feel for whether somebody has experience working with kids, how long they've been working with kids, and what their approach is to working with kids. So you should get some information about that as well.
But, John, even among that, because, you know, you can be a kid from the age of 2 or 3 all the way up to 17 or 18, Are there some
adolescent too, right?
Yep, that's what I was going to ask. They must specialize by bracket a little bit, don't they?
They absolutely do. I mean, there's a big difference between a child therapist that works with kids from like 2 to 9 versus the kind of work I do, where I work with kids who are kind of from middle school through high school and beyond. And I'd be well out of my wheelhouse working with a 5-year-old. And so, yeah, I think you've got a really good point there. And when we cluster kids together, that's too broad a category.
Right.
So you really want, if you've got a younger child, you want to know you're working with somebody who works specifically with younger children. That's a whole different kind of therapy than it is with working with adolescents.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Quick break and we'll wrap this up. 312-981-7200. How to find the right therapist. We have some questions via the phone line and the text line. Bill Left, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. Dr. John Duffy in the studio, clinical psychologist. Check out his book, The Available Parent. It's really helpful. You can go to drjohnduffy.com. A lot of questions, a lot of texts involving check with your insurance company. If I may say, in-network doctors are not always the best, which I have realized. I saved a lot of money, but I lost a lot of time.
Right. No, it's really tricky, especially when you're working with a specialty like kids, adolescents. There are fewer docs than there are that work with, you know, high functioning adults. Just kind of some of the backdoor tricks of the trade are that a lot of therapists have sliding scales and some work for social service agencies that are really, really very good therapists. So if you're willing to do some groundwork to find the right match for your kid, which to my thinking is the most important thing, finding that fit. My bias would be to even go beyond who your provider suggests and think about like, okay, so who might provide a sliding scale that I can meet? Or is there somebody out there who can say like, I can provide you some results within, you know, 6 sessions and I can, or 8 sessions or 12. And that's so much better than going 30 sessions with somebody who's half as expensive, you know? So really think through the process and how you want it to go and do a little cost benefit analysis about, you know, like, okay, how much am I investing here versus the value that I'm getting from this therapist?
And people are confused as to where to even begin. My first shot was at the pediatrician. Mm-hmm. Ask the pediatrian, someone you trust, your doctor, you know, a parental doctor, you know. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of Googling. You can Google online. You can find out people's specialty, whether it's adolescent, whether it's child, whether it's adult. And call them you're a psychologist. If someone called you and said, I'm thinking about getting an appointment for my son, may I ask you a few questions, would you take a little time to discuss something with them?
Absolutely, 100%. So yes, if there's a therapist in your area and you're not sure whether they work with, you know, the specialty that you're working for or you're looking for, absolutely call that therapist and say, hey, you know what, I'm a little lost here. Give me a little guidance. Most of us know each other. You know what I mean? The therapy community is fairly tight. Mm-hmm. So if I didn't know somebody, I would know somebody who knew somebody. So absolutely reach out to a therapist that you know and you like.
And even if you don't know if there's one in your area, give them a call
and
say,
call.
Here, I don't know where to start. Do you do this? Do you handle this? And if you don't, can you refer me to someone who does? That's a good way to start.
That's the best way to find a good match for especially your child.
You mentioned a minute or so ago, John, about getting results within 6 or 8 or 10 sessions. At what point can the psychologist determine if this is somebody you're going to be seeing for 6 or 8 or 10 sessions or for years? When do you know that?
It's a great question. You know, I'm always reticent to say if somebody tells you that, you know, like, okay, I can fix your kid in 8 sessions. You know, my question is, you know, have you met the child yet?
Yeah.
You know, because you want some idea of what you're working with and that the number of sessions it takes to guide somebody toward mental wellness. It varies quite a bit. So it might be, you know, rarely is it as few as 6 sessions, but, you know, a dozen or 24, you should be able within a few sessions to give parents some idea of how long this process is going to take.
Okay.
And don't expect results overnight.
Right.
Because I have and I've been let down.
Oh. All right.
With me and the kids.
Yeah.
It's, you know, finding an inner balance and, that's going to happen and something's going to click. And then at that point, what do you do? Do you, tell the kid, okay, so now it's not weekly, now it's biweekly, maybe it's monthly, and then say, just call now if you need something? Is that how you break up with your patients?
Yeah, I mean, you do it kind of slowly and gradually over time. And initially, most therapists want to see kids or adults every week, on rare occasion, twice a week if there's something more severe going on. And over time, that should kind of titrate down to once every couple of weeks and then once a month and then maybe a check-in and then therapy's over, but you're welcome back anytime, you know, because sometimes kids like to know, like, well, I like to know that that person's there if I want to talk to them sometime in the future.
Yeah. An adult ally that's not your parent is very important. I imagine kids you've helped go away to college and maybe if they're experiencing some kind of issue, they get in touch with you. Is
Absolutely.
That common?
Yep. It's actually really common. And, you know, I think a lot of kids benefit from that. Just knowing, like, okay, there's somebody out there that I can reach out to and that is going to just be an ear for me that's not my mom and dad. So they don't carry that anxiety that my parents carry. And I can just talk it through with them without judgment and without them pushing a solution on me. Sometimes I just want to be heard, you know, and so.
And parents don't listen a lot.
Parents
so
don't listen a lot. We get anxious.
Parent.
Yeah. Most colleges at this point have at least one and sometimes multiple psychologists on staff to help with kids at the school, right?
That's actually love college counseling centers. Typically, you get PhD students at the college who are eager to do really good work. They're young enough that they can kind of relate to what the students are going through.
Right.
So I strongly encourage that. You know, with a lot of kids, I don't think you have to have a profound issue to go and have a touchstone at the counseling and psychological services department at your college.
Mm-hmm.
Just to have a touchstone in case something goes amiss and you've got somebody you can reach out to.
That's
so, you know, I encourage that.
Yeah.
He's the best, Dr. John Duffy. You can find him at drjohnduffy.com. And seriously, The Available Parent is a great read, and we can all use some help, even though some of us think we are better parents than others. I don't think that about myself at all.
Oh. All right.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, John. A quick break. We'll check in with Steve Bertrand and find out what's coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch next. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN. Kim, thank you so much. It's us. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. And you can participate, you know, at 312-981-7200. We would love to hear from you. You can call us or you can text us.
You are so quick to get back to work.
Well, yeah. I mean, we only get two shows a day. I keep saying, can we take another hour off at 3 and then come back later on and do
another? Bite your tongue.
I want to do 3. I'll do 4 shows. I want to... You know, Liza Minnelli was doing 5 shows a day for a little while.
And look at what happened to her.
Yeah, all right. She's 2 shows alive. Is plenty. Yeah, Liza's
okay.
Fine. Liza's fine.
She's alive.
There's, yeah. Did you see, there's a man who attended the buffet at Golden Corral. Now, this was a restaurant I didn't even know we had here in Chicago.
We do?
Yeah. There's a couple of them. I think there's one in Tinley Park, I think. We were talking about it about 2 years ago because we were... Both of us were watching some show on cable where they kept advertising Golden Corral and their all-you-can-eat buffet, and we both made the same observation that there wasn't a single food on the planet that you couldn't find there. They were just showing you stuff that you go, wait a minute, they only have that in Australia. They don't even have that in the United States. But you could get it on the Golden Corral Buffet. Do you remember that? A couple of years ago, two years ago.
I do remember that, because didn't they have lobster or something, and we were shocked
about it. Yes, they did.
Because I said I wanted to go, because I like a good buffet, of course.
Yeah.
And I like lobster, but then we started talking about, is that really the lobster you want?
Well, it might not be the finest quality lobster.
Although lobster's lobster, it's just how big it is.
Right.
We used to go there all the time when my son played football, and all these eighth grade football players would just line up at the Golden Corral line buffet. You should have seen their plates.
You know where you see this? You see this if you go to Las Vegas with any regularity. Every one of the hotels has a buffet. Some of them have an A room and a B room. Like, I remember the Rio had one that was like a really, really high-end buffet with lobster and crab and stuff like that. And then they had another one that was a standard buffet. But you just see these people just loading up so much food that you go, if you started now, you couldn't eat that all week.
It's like a cruise, too,
yeah,
same thing.
Yeah.
See, I'm trying to figure out why I like buffets so much. And it comes back to when I was younger, we went to an Easter brunch once.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big special occasion. It was the first year we weren't away somewhere at someone's house. We just said, let's do a buffet. Mm-hmm. And I was astounded at like quality food that you could get at a buffet. You get Eggs Benedict if you wanted, then go get a little slice mm-hmm. of meat. Some I had never seen it before. So then it was like, I like buffets, but I've never been to such a quality one. You know what I mean? You pay a lot of money to do an Easter buffet or an Easter
sure.
brunch.
Right.
And then these other, there was a old country buffet near us that we went and I thought, oh, this is fun, but it was never as good.
Right. Right.
It is great to bring kids to. You're right, Kim, because it's an easy.
They'll find something yeah. they like.
French fries and pizza and
yeah.
ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a man, and he goes only by the name of Mr. Fleming. He does not want his first name. Although, if I were Mr. Fleming, I would not want my last name published.
he's really?
Opted to not have his first name published. He is suing the good people over at the Golden Corral Buffet because on the night of February the 12th, so that's
my
what
birthday.
Is that? It's for your birthday. For your birthday, Mr. Fleming attended the Golden Corral Buffet near his home, where it clearly states all you can eat on the buffet. All you can eat
that's
is what it
most
says.
Buffets are.
However, after eating nearly 50 pounds of food, they suggested to Mr. Fleming that maybe he had had enough. And he said, oh, no, it says right there, all you can eat buffet. I can have more if I want more.
And he could.
He could have. He is suing the Golden Corral Buffet people for $2 million
for what?
For false advertising.
Well, they didn't, you know, put a Silence of the Lambs mask on his face and say you can't eat anymore.
Silence of the Lamb Chops. That's what they gave him for the buffet.
Perfect.
I'm thinking there might not be lamb chops at Golden Corral.
No, maybe not. Kim, in this commercial, and I don't remember what, there was some show that you and I both watched, and you said to me the next day that you go, where's the closest Golden Corral buffet? Because I got to go there.
They had the lobster is what did it, and it was everything.
They showed every kind of food you could ever imagine.
Okay, so maybe not lamb chops, but still, they didn't stop him. They just, at this point, how did they know he ate 50 pounds of food?
Here's the story. This is out of World News Daily Report. According to a witness to the events, the 51-year-old man,
he was eating
Mr.
his
Fleming,
food in age. He was gone
yeah,
for 51
right,
pounds, and then he was going
right.
to go. They stopped him early.
That's a fun game to play at an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Good
if
God.
You can eat your age, you get some carrot cake. Everybody loves that. According to witnesses, more than one, the 51-year-old Mr. Fleming, who sadly lives on welfare, was expelled
Aww.
From the Golden Corral buffet after he spent more than 7 hours
okay.
on site. 7 hours.
Even I couldn't do that. Oh, my God.
I know. Ingesting a quantity of food which has been estimated at somewhere between 50 to 70 pounds.
Yeah, but then you get your person, you get your kid who pays and doesn't eat anything. So it evens
it averages out. All right. I don't know who we would ask this question of, but is that physically possible? Could somebody eat between 50 to 70 pounds of food in a 7-hour interval? Can you do? I don't think you can do that.
Did
Can
he go
you?
Outside for a smoke? Did he go take a nap in the car and come back?
No, it says here, Wendy, that sadly, the Golden Corral's all-you-can-smoke buffet closed in January. So he just missed that by a month.
No lamb chops there, just a lung chop.
It was an untimely fire.
Right. Terrible.
Well, I mean, they didn't kick him out. They just suggested maybe it's time, you know.
It says, despite the fact that the restaurant advertised the buffet, the Golden Corral Buffet, as, again, I quote here, all you can eat, the manager of the establishment seems to have lost patience at some point, telling him that his meal would be free, but he asked him to leave. The manager's intervention angered Mr. Fleming. I wouldn't want to anger Mr. Fleming. And a brief altercation took place before he finally was pushed out of the restaurant.
Oh, well then, somebody is saying that this totally happened on The Simpsons. Homer sued an all-you-can-eat seafood buffet after they dragged him
the
out.
The one with that
I do
sea
remember
captain.
That, yes.
Right. I
Didn't
remember that episode.
They changed them kind of for a while. They were calling them all you care to eat.
Were they?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It should be all we think you can eat.
Right.
It shouldn't be all you can eat because that... That's limitless. That's infinity. But if the management reserves the right to go, I think you've eaten enough, sir, Mr. Fleming. Please,
you can stay for 12 hours and eat all we share to serve you.
You know, I'm glad they're not limiting it to the plate, because I'm the one who will go through 20 plates of, because I don't like my food to touch.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll do one plate of salad, and then I'll go back and try a little something else. So I don't like load. Like, I do see people walking back
A mountain of food.
Yeah, but your stomach could not hold 50 pounds of food.
I can't imagine that's true.
Your stomach is like the size of your fist.
I should tell you.
So, God, Donald Trump's stomach is smaller than the rest of ours.
He couldn't eat much at all. parenthetically, Mr. Fleming is a larger man, if that makes any difference
in
the story.
Stomach, I mean, your inner stomach, not the fat around it, but your actual stomach could not hold 50 pounds of food.
I don't think so. I can't imagine that can be right. He immediately called the police. This is the manager of the Golden Corral Buffet.
Oh, my God, 911. What is your emergency?
Right. There's a man who won't leave our buffet. We'll get right on that.
He called, or the man called,
oh,
or the
right, Mr. Fleming called.
Right, 911. What's your emergency? Come on, play the part.
I want more pudding. I must have more pudding. He immediately celebrity voice impersonated.
I was just gonna say
that was not the actual Mr. Fleming.
Yes, it was Fat Bastard.
I want more pudding. He immediately called the police and filed a complaint against the Golden Corral restaurant. He intends to make the people responsible for his mistreatment pay for their actions. It's a serious injustice, and I am deeply insulted, Mr. Fleming told reporters. With my income, I rarely go to the restaurant, so I try to get as much as I can for my money when I do.
I get that, but you can't, like, save up on it, like, not eat for months and then eat 50 pounds of food.
I don't think so either. This was, again, this is Mr. Fleming, this was the worst experience I have ever had in a restaurant. Not only did they kick me out while I was still hungry.
Bow, bow, bow.
He was still hungry after 50 to 70 pounds of food, but they looked at me like I was disgusting, like I was not worthy of eating there. It's unacceptable, and I demand compensation to the tune of $2 million. The direction of the restaurant chain quickly issued a press release announcing that the decision to expel Mr. Fleming was a regrettable personal initiative from an overzealous franchise manager. Could they have used more flowery language to describe that? We thought the guy had enough. It should have just said that. We said, hey, this guy's had enough. They also said that some financial indemnities had been offered to compensate the damage suffered by the victim. He's a victim, Wendy. He's not just a complainant. He is a victim. But that offer has been refused. Mr. Fleming confirmed that he had been offered a significant amount of money by the company, but he is convinced that he can get more if he goes to court. Again, we're talking about $2 million. The primary hearing in this case would take place on March the 7th in the Springfield District Court. Well, Springfield, once again, is a Simpsons reference.
Yeah, this doesn't seem right.
It's right here in World News Daily Report.
Wait, would it be in the food court in Springfield?
Yes.
All right. Well, this is completely impossible, because I just looked up how much the maximum capacity for the stomach of an average human. Can we take a break?
Yeah, let's
can
take
I
a break.
Say, there's no way it could hold 50 pounds, as you speculate.
I can't see it. All right. We'll take a quick break. If you'd like to jump in, please do. 312-981-7200. Bill and Wendy, WGN. Can this story possibly be true? Could a guy have could he be suing the Golden Corral chain for going to a buffet and being denied more food after eating 50 to 70 pounds of food? Is this real or is it fake?
Well, first, let's pretend that this story is real. Hey, Bodie.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, Bode. What's going on?
Good. Hey, I was just thinking, as you're talking, for those that remember, Monty Python, The Life of Brian, when the guy's hoarding, he says, "Give me another bucket. I think I'm going to puke." So I'm thinking that Golden Corral must have bucket boys hanging out there for these type of people.
Wait, it's meaning of life, right? Where
yeah,
Monty Python
I think
has
it's the meaning of life.
No, meaning of life. Okay.
Is it meaning of life?
One more waffle thin mint.
Mr. Creosote,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, exactly.
That's the guy?
Yeah.
Little quail's eggs and a bed of pureed mushroom. It's very delicate, very subtle.
I'll have the lot.
A wise choice, monsieur. Now, how would you like it served? All mixed up together in a bucket?
Yeah, with the eggs on top.
buttercase avec des œufs frites.
Yeah, don't skimp on the pâté.
Oh, monsieur, I assure you, just because it is mixed up with all the other things, we would not dream of giving you less than the full amount. In fact, I will personally make sure you have a double helping. Maintenant, quelque chose à boire, something to drink, monsieur.
Yeah, I'll have six bottles of Chateau Latour 45. And a double Jeroboam of champagne.
Bon, and the usual brown ales?
Yeah. No, wait a minute, I think I could only manage six crates today.
I hope monsieur was not overdoing it last night.
Shut up!
D'accord. Ah, the new bucket and the cleaning woman.
Oh, God. He's
yeah,
throwing up.
Yeah, you don't need to. Yeah,
stop
people
playing
are
that. Is
lunch.
That what you're talking about, Bode?
Yeah, yeah, that's the one.
A magical right. moment from the world of cinema. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
All right, take care.
Can I just tell you real quickly, I watched Monty Python every Sunday night on Channel 11 with my family, mm-hmm. and I laughed when they laughed because to this day I still can't understand them. I seriously have a difficult time understanding that thick accent.
Yeah, sure.
All right,
sure.
We figured out, he allegedly, they speculated it was 50 pounds of food that perhaps he ate.
Which is impossible. Somewhere right. between 50 to 70 pounds of food. Your body can't hold that. That's impossible.
Well, the maximum capacity for the stomach of an average human, and yeah. I assume this is a human, the stomach is a muscular bag.
Thank you.
Being made of muscles, it's easily stretchable. So although normally a feeling of fullness would set in on consuming about 1 liter of food for most people, mm-hmm. the stomach can hold a lot more than that because of its elasticity. Mm-hmm. Normally about 1.5 to 2 liters. Now 1 liter of water is equal to 2.20 pounds of
okay.
water.
All right.
So normally, maybe let's say 2 liters is your normal stomach. So that would be
4.5 pounds.
Yes. Maximum capacity 3 to 4 liters, so we're talking maybe 8.5 to 9
roughly,
pounds.
Roughly, yeah.
No 50 pounds.
Although, I guess, if this were true, somebody could keep, you know, even if you kept going to the bathroom, because
no.
it says he was there for
you
7 hours.
You don't digest food that quickly.
No, you don't. No.
Well, it's funny because you have been, someone texted us actually at 312-981-7200 and said the story is false. And sure as...
is it false?
I hope almost swore right there. Sure as heck.
You can swear.
According to Snopes, I've got a little story for you today.
Go on.
It says that several fake news sites ran with a fabricated tale of an overweight man purportedly suing because he was booted from a buffet restaurant at Golden Corral.
Is it Mr. Fleming? The one and same?
Yes, he lives on welfare, suing for wealth. What does he contribute? Blah, blah, blah. The story is false. On February 12th, 2016, the website World News Daily Report.
That's where I got the story.
Published an article claiming a 51-year-old welfare recipient was suing Golden Corral after he was ejected from a restaurant for spending more than 7 hours at the buffet. And they are saying it is false. That according to Snopes.com. I went on to Snopes.com and looked up World News Daily Report. How many words in the title? I mean, it doesn't sound real. You were so cute off the air going, isn't that real? Well, they have put together a whole fake news invasion, Snopes Field Guide to Fake News Sites and Hoax Purveyors, and I am going to send this to you.
Please.
National
send it to
Report
me.
Is fake. World News Daily Report.
Yeah,
fake. Hustlers, not Hustlers.
Hustlers is real.
Right.
Hustlers is fake.
H-U-Z-L-E-R-S, fake.
Fox News, fake.
Empire News.
That's where I get
fake.
All my carpet news.
Stupid with two P's, fake news.
Wait, I've never even heard of that one. I'm going to subscribe to that one.
Naha Daily, N-A-H-A.
Naha Daily's real.
Naha. And the Stately Herald.
I
I'm
going
to send this
fake.
To you.
All right.
Now 8 News. Boy, the headline on the Now 8 News, I don't think
can
be read on the air.
No, you can't say that. Nope.
Cookie dough can explode in a certain area during a woman's shoplifting incident.
No, you can't say that. Can't say that. All right. Well,
Mama's cooking now.
You have fooled me, World News Daily Report.
I'm sending this to you.
And I just bought a 2-year subscription, so I feel like it's a waste of my money.
You have been duped several times lately.
3 times since December.
That's not good.
That's a higher average than I'm proud of.
Can I tell you?
I've been taken three different times by stories I see on the internet that are in more than one place. Like, this was at World News, but it was at more than one source.
Because other people picked that up because, you know, their monsters. Editors are your friends.
I guess so.
I mean, you come in with some of these bizarre stories in the morning that you give to Kevin, and it's like, where did you find this?
Like now that one about Trump winning all the Super Tuesday states?
Unfortunately, that one's
real. That one's
real.
That one's real. Rich Lenkoff will join us at 2:05. Kristen McQuarrie joins us at 2:35. We have a lot coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
It's Bill and Wendy. It's 720 WGN. Steve, I don't know if you are watching. I know Bill and I are watching The People versus O.J. Simpson. Are you caught up on that?
No, I lived it. I don't want to go back.
It is interesting. If you're, are you watching with your kids? Because
yes.
My daughters were not around when any of this played out, so it's all kind of new to them. Although, as it was pointed out to me, and I applaud their school for this, they studied a little bit of this in school, in high school, in a history class. I didn't know that was part of the history class curriculum.
Why
That's
is it?
Excellent. Just because I guess it falls under current events to some extent. It's not that current, but...
They're not teaching 9/11? They're not talking about that in schools?
No, they both of them had said that 9/11 was discussed in great detail as well.
And that's high school, because junior high, it's not really discussed too much.
Right, right.
God, the O.J. trial.
Yeah, it came up, because they knew like way more than I thought they would have.
It is pretty funny, and as you're watching, you know, we know the outcome.
Yeah.
I think Dylan was the one asking, what did he really kill her? And, you know, it's my husband will be like, yes, got, you know, he, and it's like, well, wait a minute. At this point, we truly didn't know if he did. All the evidence pointed to it.
Yeah.
And then, I actually forgot about the fact, that he's in jail now because of that, memorabilia show thing. Mm-hmm. But would your average, like, had he not killed two people? Allegedly beforehand, would he have gone to jail for that?
I don't think he would have been doing sports card shows had their deaths not happened. I don't think.
Well, there were a couple of things, and I know that you had read something about the real people in the O.J. Simpson case.
Right.
Coming forth and saying that's not exactly how it happened.
Marcia Clark in particular has said, I read a lengthy interview with her where she said, they changed this, they moved this, I never said this. So there were, you know, they took some liberties.
I'm having a bit of an issue with the book that this is based on, because do you notice the commercials within the, you know, oh, you can purchase the book, and mm-hmm. I don't remember the guy's name, and watch it, you'll see it enough. And then it based on the novel by, but then you're wondering, how accurate is this? And there were a couple of scenes last night that I questioned. One, when Johnny Cochran is driving his daughters to dinner,
mm-hmm.
and he gets pulled over by a motorcycle police officer,
mm-hmm.
and they just pulled him over, and he's being very polite, and he's saying, girls, just give daddy a minute, we'll be going out to dinner soon. And it's like, officer, may I ask... He goes to get the registration of his car, and the cop says, put your hands on the wheel, put your hands on the wheel. And he's in a nice white area of L.A.
Yeah.
And at one point, he says, may I ask why I was pulled over? And the cop said, you know, a couple of blocks ago, you didn't use your turn signal. I find that strange, because I always use it, especially with my daughters in the car. And he's playing it so cool.
Right.
And then they handcuff him, and it was
he
just
points
like
out it's the third time he'd been pulled over in recent weeks.
And he was being so cool
for
about
not
it.
Doing anything wrong. Yeah.
Didn't he have an attitude, and he was being respectful and polite to the officer?
Yeah.
And I just found it weird, first of all, that he was handcuffed right then and there in front of his daughters.
Yeah.
I wondered if that really happened. And why wouldn't he whip out his name at that time and go, do you know who I am? Doesn't do any of that. He said, you know, why don't you check my registration and call in my license plate, and then you will find out how sorry you will be for this.
Yeah, right.
And right away the cop comes back and takes the handcuffs off and doesn't say I'm sorry. At that point, wouldn't you say, I'm so sorry, there's been a misunderstanding, but no.
Maybe, but I was having the same problem with it as you were. Was it just to advance the storyline, or did that event actually take place? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure.
Because I didn't realize about. I know there was racial strife going on, Rodney King and riots and other things. I didn't know this focused so much on that.
Well, they were. That was a big deal when they, when the trial was or the verdict was going to be announced.
Oh, okay, I do remember that.
The police were prepared.
I do remember that.
There's also the issue in last night's episode. Anyway, the jury gets to visit the crime scene. And they change his house.
They staged it to make him look more African American.
Right. They changed all the artwork and everything to make him look more African American. And Kylie was watching with me and said, "Why would they let OJ? Like I guess that's fairly standard with a crime like this, where the jury is allowed to take a field trip.
I don't think
so. Well, I know there's been other cases where that part's happened, but I don't think that OJ Simpson would have been there for that.
No, he's wasn't not a hosted party.
Right.
I had that same question.
That seemed peculiar to me. And I don't remember how history played out if they did make that field trip to the house. And
yes.
If they did make that.
Because I remember thinking that was so bizarre.
Was
they had these
there?
Buses.
In real
yes.
Life? Yeah.
How did they even let him do that and why?
I think, he has a right to defend himself and be party to the proceedings in his trial. So I wouldn't be too surprised if that's.
I remember when that happened, looking at the buses, taking the people, thinking, this is so weird that they're going to the house. And Johnny Cochran staged it because then I've decided too that Cuba Gooding Jr. is just a whiny O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
He's very like, oh, you think so? Oh, yeah. Don't. I worked hard to be the mayor of Brentwood. Oh,
yeah.
It's just whining.
Yeah. He might, we've discussed this before, he might not have been the most accurate choice to play O.J. Simpson. He's
a
good
actor,
but yeah, I know.
It's not fitting it. Well, there was one point last night that really was something I didn't remember. And we did live it, so I understand, Steve, why you're not watching it. But there is a prosecutor who is working with Marsha Clark, and now Christopher Darden has been entered into the team.
Right.
And his name is Bill Hodgman, who I don't remember at all.
I remember little bits and pieces. He wasn't anywhere near as prominent as either Darden or Marsha Clark, but I know he was on the team.
Well, they showed last night in the episode, and I'm on the New York Daily News right now. This is just 5 hours ago. It showed in the made-for-TV movie, spoiler alert, if you're not up to date and you've recorded it, go away for a little bit. He got all upset because the defense did not give a list of witnesses that they were going to call. So Bill Hodgman and Marsha Clark and Chris Darden are hearing about these witnesses in the opening statements. And Bill says, I hate to interfere with the opening statements here, but we know nothing about this. And he gets really riled up and he's like, you know, sweating. And at one point, Judge Ito says, you know, take a deep breath, Bill. You need to take it easy. And he has a heart attack and gets taken away in a stretcher and ambulance in the middle of the courtroom on opening day.
Right. Yeah.
Now, I don't recall that ever happening. And I know TV writers can do what they want. And these TV writers usually have their fingers on the pulse of the O.J. Simpson case. But when it comes to Bill Hodgman's so-called heart attack, not true, according
he
to
didn't
the
have a heart attack.
New York Daily News. I didn't remember that. Contrary to Tuesday's episode of The People versus O.J. Simpson, the quiet, steadfast co-prosecutor in the trial of the century did not dramatically collapse in Judge Lance Ito's courtroom from a heart attack, according to multiple reports from the actual trial. Rather, Deputy District Attorney Hodgman, played by Christian Clemenson, complained of chest pains during a strategy meeting hours later and was taken to the hospital out of an abundance of caution, according to the LA Times. An ER doctor later confirmed there was no evidence of a heart attack, but he was not taken out of the courtroom. That really is.
So why would you take a case that was already the most dramatic case of the last century?
I know.
And throw in details like that? You would think the story on itself would hold up, wouldn't you?
Yes.
I don't know why they would add that.
I mean, I am just getting my weekly fix of John Travolta as Robert Shapiro, and it's just, getting more amusing to me.
And now he's clashing a lot with F. Lee Bailey, which is fun. I guess it's fun to watch, right?
It is, but you...
Because he got Nathan Lane and Vinny Barbarino fighting back and forth. That's fun. I've always wanted to see that. Now I get to see that.
But the guy, I mean, Robert Shapiro was very, he had a lot of flair and stuff. But Travolta's so over the top, and Johnny Cochran, the guy playing Johnny Cochran, is not over the top enough.
Yeah.
Because Cochran was really...
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So according to the New York Daily News, Hodgman had a very brief episode of chest pains. Mm-hmm. Clinically, extremely well. That night, Los Angeles County District Attorney Gil Garcetti reportedly told media the then 41-year-old prosecutor was feeling 200% better an hour ago than he did 4 hours ago.
Oh.
So that was not accurate. And I know your mileage may vary when it comes to TV movies.
Right.
But there's enough sensationalism and excitement in this case alone. It seems weird they'd go so over the top.
I was enjoying how this episode, because as we've pointed out in previous episodes, Ryan Murphy, the guy who's behind all this, is the same guy who does Glee and he does American Horror Story, and he tends to do things big. And this one seemed a little more subtle to me. The director last night was John Singleton, who did Boys in the Hood and is an accomplished director and rarely, if ever, does television. So that could be part of the reason last night's was a little more in check. Although, as you've pointed out, there were some discrepancies as to what really did or didn't happen.
And just a legal question, which I know you won't have the answer to, but doesn't it seem like it's not legal to go restage OJ's house? When they changed it, it's like at one point you've got Cuba Gooding Jr. saying, and who are those people on the wall? They're not even my kids. I don't know those people.
If the purpose of that field trip was to show them kind of an isolated version of what the habitat was like.
It's not what it was, though. That's kind of...
Then that's misleading.
Rich Lankoff's here. We should ask him about
that. All right. More show coming your way next. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
Hey, did you ever listen to Legal Face Off on WGN Plus?
I binge listen. I listen to all the episodes at once. It's more fun that way.
Well, one of the partners in crime, Rich Lankoff, attorney Rich Lankoff, in the studio with us right now. And it's funny you should just drop in because we were just talking about the People versus O.J. Simpson and the episode last night. You're a little behind on it. Are you enjoying this, by the way? Because I love
it. It's a love-hate thing going
on.
I mean, I do like it. I remember the story, obviously, as we all do, from back in the 90s. But I've got a lot of issues. I was listening to you a few minutes ago. I've got some of the same issues that you do. I think casting is weak. I think, you know, Marcia Clark comes across really poorly. And I love the actress playing her from the other Ryan Murphy show, Sarah Paulson. But she comes across, I think, not great, and she loves smoking, of course. I mean, it's like a commercial for smoking. I think she's spending half the time.
Yeah.
I think OJ is terribly cast. I mean, I like Cuba Gooding, but I think he's whiny, exactly like you said. But it's certainly interesting. I mean,
and we come back every week. Why?
Yeah, I know. It's
You know who they
trial
added?
Of the century. You have to watch it.
I know you haven't seen last night's episode yet, but they added Robert Morse. He plays Dominic Dunn, the writer.
Yeah.
Who was front
is that
and center.
Who he's supposed to be?
Yeah, that was
a whole weird dinner party. Can I just say that?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know who that was supposed to be.
Dominic Dunn, and they mentioned this a little bit in the scene with Lance Ito where he grants him permission to sit in the front row. His daughter, Dominique Dunn, is the one who was in the movie Poltergeist and was brutally killed by her boyfriend.
Right.
Terrible, terrible story.
That's right.
So they felt there was some kinship between he and the Goldman family because they both lost a family member in similar circumstances. So, and he wrote extensively about the case, you know, afterward or during and afterwards.
I couldn't figure out who that was. I must have missed the setup. But I did see the part where Johnny Cochran totally restaged OJ's house. OJ, you know, of course, had pictures of Nicole Brown Simpson all over the place and all his celebrity photos of him with a lot of white people. And he was, despite the fact that he was African-American, had worked his way up and was living in a white area of California. And they tried to, in their words, make it look like he was more of the black people. So they brought in this African art, which was really cool, and sculptures, and changed all the pictures. I love the one of he and his mother.
Yeah.
And it just really changed the whole view of what OJ stood for. And there was a scene where Marcia Clark is standing right next to Judge Lance Ito going, I can't believe it. He staged this whole thing. Where's the naked picture of Paula Barbieri? Instead, it's OJ and his mother. I mean, how can this be allowed? But is it legal? Couldn't she have objected to that? It changed the whole thing.
For sure, she should have objected. I haven't seen last night's episode yet, but yeah, if that happened in real life and the crime scene that the jury is paying a visit to,
shouldn't it
was
not
altered,
be changed since the crime?
100%. I mean, she should have been jumping up and down to object. And before that, I mean, what would happen in real life is there would be a preliminary hearing on that issue. They wouldn't just show up at the house. And the circumstances surrounding the visit would be laid out very carefully, very clearly in an order. And in that order, before they went out, it would say that the crime scene, the house in this case, wouldn't be changed. So those things would probably never happen in real life if the attorneys were doing their job. But, you know, as depicted on this show, it's a whole circus and there's not much, you know, rules being followed.
I keep calling this a field trip because I don't know what the right term is. What do they call that when the jury goes to the crime scene? Is there
a
word for that?
Field trip's a perfectly good
title. Do they call it a field trip?
Good title.
But that does happen with some regularity. It's not totally out of the ordinary for that to happen in a case like this, right?
Sure, it happens. And again, those things are very meticulously planned and staged. Obviously, you know, when you take 12 people or, you know, the alternates also to a crime scene, you want to be careful how you do that. You want to be mindful of the impact on the jury. So, again, all that would be set forth beforehand. I mean, for example, when we deal with much more minor issues in a typical civil case, just, for example, like giving a videotape to the opposing counsel, that's all subject to an order that lays out very specifically in about 20 different, you know, in a 20-point order, how that transfer will be made. So imagine if we're doing that just for a videotape, imagine bringing 12 people out to a crime scene, how much planning there would be. So that would all be subject to an order. They wouldn't be allowed to alter it in the way that the movie depicts.
But you know what? That wasn't really the crime scene because that wasn't Nicole's house.
True, but any field trip, you know, anytime you're bringing a jury out, anytime you're showing evidence, that all has to be subject to an agreement of the parties, and more importantly, an order of the court. Yeah, they would just not be allowed to, you know, make that house look the way the movie depicts.
Oh my God! And would OJ have been there? I know he was because I remember this. But isn't that odd that they would release him?
Especially a guy who had an incident, the Bronco incident, where he was trying to flee. Would they still allow
and or
a guy,
kill himself?
Or,
yeah.
Or kill himself?
Remember, he's the main defendant, so he has the right to be a party, to be present at all of the proceedings against him, including that field trip. So that part is not that unusual. He would have the right to be there, but certainly the defense wouldn't have the right to alter it in the way the movie depicts them.
And we know this part to be true. Anyone who's familiar with OJ's case knows this. He had this dream team of lawyers. It looks like there's 8 or 9 attorneys at some point. Is there a limit to how many lawyers you can have defending you?
Yeah, it's a great question. No, I mean,
there isn't.
No, I mean, most people can't afford, you know, one good criminal lawyer, let alone the 8 or 9 that OJ has. So that's why you don't typically see that. But no, I mean, you have the right to choose counsel. You have the right to your own counsel, and there's no limit on the amount of people that you can have with you.
And they can switch off whenever they like you, as you know from the case. You got Shapiro doing lead for a little while. Then you got Johnny Cochran coming in. You had Barry Sheck coming in. I mean, they kind of kept jumping in and out.
You can. Again, you know, the courtroom is the judge's domain. The judge decides how each case will proceed. And I would expect that prior to a case involving multiple counsel for the same side, it's not unusual to see multiple counsels for different parties, right?
Yeah.
But when you have one defendant like OJ, I would expect that Judge Ito or any judge would, at the beginning of the case, say, listen, this is not going to be a circus. Even though you have several attorneys, we're going to have one be the lead.
Right.
So that would all be dealt with initially in this case. And obviously the movie is a little bit dramatic. You see people coming in and out. But to answer your question, no, the OJ has the right to hire as many lawyers as he wants. The judge obviously has the right to sort of clamp down on who's speaking when.
Yeah.
It's when you look at the courtroom and you look at the defense team, it's like they're the Dallas Cowboys in their spangly outfits. And then you look at Marcia Clark and Chris Darden and it looks like the Bad News Bears are up against them. I mean, it's just, you got the dream team and then you got two people.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as the movie progresses, you see Marcia Clark having less confidence in her case. I think initially they were very confident that,
absolutely,
listen, this is a home run. We've got this in the bag and we don't need a dream team, right? We're fine with prosecuting with, you know, one or maybe two people. Mm-hmm. I don't think she understood early on what she was stacked up against. And she felt, listen, I have prosecuted successfully much, much more difficult cases than this. So I don't think she felt like I need, you know, much help. But as history tells us, that wasn't the case.
Does she still smoke? That's what I would like to
know. I don't
know
if she does or not. I'm not sure.
Okay. His name is Rich Lankoff. You can hear him on Legal Faceoff at WGNplus.com. Another case that's in the news is this whole Aaron Andrews civil suit. Will you be talking about that this weekend?
We will, yeah. Oddly enough, I was in Nashville last week when this civil trial started. It wasn't my plan. I was there for business. And I was with a client in a bar. And as I'm walking out, guess who I see? Aaron Andrews
really?
In the bar. And I didn't realize the trial was starting that day, and I looked it up quickly why she was there, and they had picked the jury that day. Yeah, following it closely, we're going to be addressing it in detail on Legal Faceoff on Friday. Really interesting case, a lot of interesting legal issues.
Of course. Rich, thanks for being here. I appreciate
Thank
that.
You
That's
very
Rich
much.
Lankoff. We'll take a quick break, and then more show coming your way next, Bill and Wendy on WGN. But Steve, you have to admit, it is so nice to have her back where she belongs.
It is. It's good to have her there.
It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. A big guest coming sometime between now and the end of the show. A huge guest. And that's all we're going to say right now.
Super Tuesday results. We've got them for you. We're going to talk to the Tribune's Kristen McQueary in just moments. And it looks like it's gotten down to two potential winners here.
Two?
Well, on each side. Donald Trump and one Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yeah. Kristen McQueary joins us right now from the Chicago Tribune to talk about what happened yesterday. Kristen, first of all, thank you. There was some rescheduling that went on behind the scenes because of a pending guest, and we appreciate you helping us out and coming in a little earlier than you were scheduled. Hi.
I understand I'm getting bumped for somebody really important.
Well, you're really important.
No, I think this is exciting.
Yeah, I'll be down there in a half hour, Kristen.
Steve will be down later on, too.
Good one, Bertrand. So right now it looks like we've got Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I know things can change, but looking pretty good for those two individuals.
It really is. It was just a Trump-tastic, super huge Tuesday for Donald Trump, and Hillary Clinton did really well, too. But I would not count Bernie Sanders out. So he won four states last night, Colorado, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Vermont. And the next couple of states, I think he might do okay. I mean, he's going to hang in there. I don't know that the math is going to work out for him. But
it's certainly not over yet for him.
It is not over yet for him. And I mean, there's some value in sticking around so that the people who have been, you know, you're waiting for your state's primary and you want to cast a ballot for him. Next up on Saturday is Kansas, Louisiana, Nebraska. I think he's going to do pretty well in those states. And then March 8th is right around the corner, and that's a big one. Hawaii, Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi. So he's well-funded.
Yeah.
You know, he can, you know, hang with Hillary for maybe the next week, and I think he should.
There was discussion last night after most of the results, but not all of the results were in, about the importance, and this was mostly for Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, but the importance of winning your home state. Is that crucial?
It really is. I mean, if Rubio does not win Florida, the deal is sealed, and it pretty much is already. I mean, he didn't do well last night. He won one state. I think he was hoping for closer margins in some of the other states, but he's just way far, you know, behind Trump and Cruz. And actually, Cruz is still pretty far behind Trump.
Yeah, he is.
So I think this is the end of the road for Marco Rubio. And I don't know if that's because of that one bad debate performance. Remember where he kept...
They said he was robotic.
He was very robotic and he kept repeating himself, and Chris Christie kind of jumped on him. That really kind of just sucked the air out of his campaign.
That's too bad.
It's too bad. It's like that 1 minute can really just send you in a death spiral.
I was earlier in the show, I was explaining, I was watching CNN. And he, Marco Rubio, was on with Jake Tapper, and Jake Tapper asked him, because he seemed very upbeat, despite the fact he came in third pretty much across the board, a little bit of variance. But Jake Tapper asked him if he was delusional, and he didn't break on it. He said, no, I'm positive things are going in the right direction, and on and on and on and on. They then analyzed him, the staff there at CNN, and they said that not only is he ruining his chances of being the president, or not even ruining, but it's just not materializing, but they said at this point, because of his poor showing, he's not even going to be considered for vice president. But that wasn't ever going to happen, was it?
It certainly was not going to happen when he started calling Trump a con artist, which is what he's saying now everywhere on the campaign trail. So I think he made a decision that he was going to, you know, go after Trump in a very full-throated way, and that will definitely, you know, you can't have a vice presidential candidate who you don't trust.
Right.
Ben Carson is announcing that he's suspending his campaign. He is mentioned sometimes as a possible Trump running mate. And did you see Chris Christie standing behind Trump during his victory speech last night?
He wants to be vice president.
I don't know why else you would make such a public and risky decision to endorse Trump like that if you weren't wanting, you know, to be considered for vice president.
Will Trump choose him? Aren't you dying to know who the running mates are going to be?
Yeah, I think it's always really fascinating, and it usually doesn't happen until summer. So we won't know until right before the convention.
Yeah, that's where it usually gets announced. Who threw Bill Rancic's name at us yesterday? We're both like, that could never. Hey.
Somebody texted that in.
Did somebody text that in yesterday?
Yeah, and you know what? That's not a bad idea.
He's a trusted friend.
Yeah.
He's from in Chicago still, right?
The Rancic. I think so.
He's from a Midwestern state, which would help Trump. You know, you always want to balance geographically your choice.
But think about that. These are two guys who, I don't remember the exact year that Bill Rancic was a contestant on The Apprentice, but that's the impact that that reality TV has on our society now, is the host and the winner of a reality television show could be the president and vice president.
But, you know, maybe Hillary will pick Kim Kardashian.
I was just going to say, well, next year.
Would that be a good choice?
Next term, Kanye has said he's running, and of course he's going to pick his wife to be, you know, his running mate.
Don't count out the Ice Road Truckers. Trust me, these guys are a force to be reckoned with, Kristen.
That's right. Who are the Duck Dynasty guys?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they would just...
Official statement by Dr. Ben Carson on his very website. I have decided not to attend the Fox News GOP presidential debate tomorrow night in Detroit. Even though I will not be in my hometown of Detroit on Thursday, I remain deeply committed to my home nation, America. I do not see a political path forward in light of last evening's Super Tuesday primary results. However, this grassroots movement on behalf of we the people will continue.
Honorable guy, exiting with grace.
Yeah, he seems
to be. Someone who was a true outsider and you know, had a very faith-based following, but just too small.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he won. How many delegates did he end up with total? Five?
Yeah,
six?
It was a very low number.
Yeah.
All right, so if we look at the three potential candidates, you had Carly Fiorina, who did not fare very well. You had Ben Carson, who I guess was somewhere in the middle, not quite up to par. And you had Donald Trump, who looks like he's going to win the whole thing. What does this say about the future in terms of anybody who says, I've spent my whole life out of politics, but I'm going to give it a shot? Anything could happen.
Hey, if you've got, you know, $30 billion in the bank, you're home free.
Right.
I mean, really, he has been funding his own campaign, and that is crucial to anybody who wants to jump in with no organization that can't be ignored.
Except we still don't have Bloomberg's decision, do we?
We don't, but it would be very hard for him to run because you can't go back and try to get delegates now.
Right.
I mean, he's not even on the ballot in a lot of these states. We are voting in less than 2 weeks in Illinois.
Yeah.
15th? You know, Kristen,
correct.
Mitt Romney says apparently he's going to have a big speech tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh.
A big comment about this.
Oh.
What would that be?
You know, I don't know if he's going to... He previously was kind of hinting that there might be something in Trump's tax returns, and then Trump sort of jumped all over Mitt. So I don't really think Mitt Romney's going to say anything other than, you know, kind of what the establishment Republicans have been saying, which is we don't want this guy in the White House, you know, trying to maybe drum up support for Ted Cruz. But I don't think he's going to make any sort of like a campaign announcement.
What could possibly surprise us now about Donald Trump? Seriously.
It's a great question. Nothing. I mean, this is someone who has been divorced multiple times, filed for bankruptcy, runs casinos, strip clubs.
Oh, I think you're going to find that he paid a very low tax rate. I mean, he's even foreshadowed that a little bit, right? Saying, just like me, I try to pay as little taxes as possible.
People see that, though. Look what he's going to do. He's going to make it so we can all pay the least amount possible.
No,
good for him.
Not if he's paying half the rate you're paying.
I never seem to think that resonates with voters, though,
really?
Steve. Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. There's a Wall Street Journal piece today that, you know, and it's the Wall Street Journal, so you have to take that with a grain of salt. They are generally, you know, pro-low taxes anyway, that kind of excuses him, that the way his businesses are set up, it shouldn't be surprising that he would pay less than we would expect.
Yeah.
But I think, like, if he doesn't give to charity or something like that,
could be a problem. We'll take a quick break and then more with Kristen McQuarrie of the Chicago Tribune. If you'd like to add in 312-981-7200, we'll get that done. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
And it's Prince Spaghetti Day. It's Wednesday.
Yes, it is.
Anthony.
Anthony
hey, Kristen
Martin
McQuarrie.
Yeti. Kristen McQuarrie writes for the Chicago Tribune, and we're talking to her about last night, about Super Tuesday, and looking forward. Now, looking forward, of the non-winners, of anyone who's not Trump, and I know it's too early to call, but let's say Donald Trump goes on to win this thing. Which of the non-winners stands a chance 4 years from now, 8 years from now, and beyond?
That's a good question. I mean, I think Ben Carson, if he got a little more up to speed on foreign policy, he could be a good candidate if we're, again, looking for sort of that outsider. I don't think this is the last we're going to see of Rubio. I mean, he hasn't even hit 40 yet. He still has a career in the Senate.
Yeah.
I could see him running. I could see Cruz running again. There are lots of rising stars in the Republican Party. Bobby Jindal, do you remember him? He's the Louisiana governor, dropped out real early. I could see him jumping in again. And then everybody talks about Nikki Haley, the South Carolina governor, who's a woman and very popular in her state, something like 80% approval ratings. So the farm team for the Republicans is pretty strong.
Yeah.
I like Dr. Ben Carson. I really do. I feel sorry for him.
The gentlest of all candidates.
I know.
He is. And, you know, he was very, you know, he was a constitutional conservative. Even if you're not crazy about, you know, his faith and him bringing that into the conversation all the time, he was very much a freedom of religion candidate, outsider, moral compass.
Yeah.
You know, you can't really say that about Donald Trump. I guess voters don't care. You know, I had this moment when I was watching last night where I just thought that for people like me who've been, you know, pontificating about this race for months, it was really like an eat crow Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
Because I probably said on this show, I always thought GOP primary voters would eventually coalesce around someone like a Ted Cruz or someone who was equally as conservative but not as bombastic
right.
as Donald Trump. Wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
But I still can't see when the election comes, them casting their vote. It's, yes, let's put him there because he represents change in the way things have been going. But I can't believe that he will win.
The demographics are going to be tough for him. He's offended so many groups.
That's it.
And I remember sitting on election night 4 years ago when Mitt Romney lost, and my just looking at the states where he did not do well, have growing and important Latino populations.
Right.
And the Republican Party does a terrible job of trying to bring them into the tent. The worst being Donald Trump. I mean, he's talking about a wall and his announcement. You know, he's talking about Mexicans coming over the border and raping our citizens.
I know. Yeah. Oh, my God.
So when you just look at the demographics of this country, that would be a tough sell, I think, for people to vote for him.
When you look at Ted Cruz's evangelical ways, is that the right direction? I know he's playing true to form. He is that way. But in the long run, will that end up hurting him and his chances? Or are there enough people who want that sort of guy? And the numbers don't seem to prove that. But if he were to come back in 4 years, would he play that up more or would he lay low on that, do you think?
Well, that's a good question because that's what got George W. Bush elected, were those really dedicated evangelical voters. In this race, about a quarter of them are voting for Trump, who is like the least faith-based person I could point to. He talked at one time about how, he went to church and he would have the little cracker and the little juice. I mean, and then he was in the middle of an Iowa faith-based auditorium setting, and they asked, I think, like, have you ever sought forgiveness from the Lord? And he said, no. No, I don't think so. So I do think that's changed
this
time. He's perfect. He doesn't need to talk to God. He is God.
Right. The art of the deal, Kristen. He knows how to deal with it.
Actually, God reached out to him a couple times.
Tell him I'll call him back.
Oh, right. I'm busy.
Send God to voicemail.
Right. Beep. So I don't know that block of voters is coalesced anymore.
Right.
I mean, if you have them going for somebody like Trump, that's different.
Really quickly, there's a phrase that we all keep hearing over and over, and now they're using it in the ads, and it's Donald Trump saying, "I love the poorly educated." What does that say, really? When you analyze that sentence and him saying that sentence, what does that say?
It says what we've been saying about Trump all along, that he basically shoots from the hip. He says whatever is at the forefront of his cerebral brain here, and the voters tolerate it. You know, I mean, that of all the things that he has said, that was just one more that in the past we would have said, oh, my gosh, gaffe, demand an apology. All of that has been wiped away with this election because I think voters got really frustrated with that sort of vanilla messaged candidates. And so it's actually okay that he said that.
Yeah.
And it just shows, you know, again, him trying to say, I'm smarter than the rest of you, and I don't care where my votes come from.
Bring me the people who aren't very smart. Those are my people.
Those are my people. That's sort of what he said. I mean, I didn't see a big uprising from, you know, people.
From dumb people?
They don't know how to use the Twitter machine.
I'm trying to think of a nice way to say it. But, you know, people who don't have advanced degrees.
That's the better way to say it.
I didn't hear
Kristen's
anybody.
Kristen's nicer than you are,
I guess.
Not usually. So I just, you know, he's beyond Teflon. He can really say anything.
So true.
Know? I mean, he wiggled around the whole KKK issue. So
my headphones weren't working. What?
Right.
He gave me this earpiece. Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
How about that? Thank you. It's Kristen McQuarrie. Read her in the Chicago Tribune. We're going to take a quick break. Steve with the news. And then we believe a huge guest coming next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thank you so much. It's me, Bill Leff. It's her, Wendy Snyder, on WGN. Anxiously awaiting the telephone call of a huge, huge guest.
All right. They grew up about 15 blocks away from each other in Brooklyn, although she didn't meet Bernie Sanders until the night he was elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont. And I got to find out what year that was. On the line with us right now, the wife of Bernie Sanders, Jane O'Meara Sanders. Hi, Jane.
Hi. How are you doing, Wendy?
We're good. And so what year was that when you first met him the night he was elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont?
1981, and he won by 10 votes.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
So he's not giving anything up, because look what can happen.
Exactly. He was not expected to win as mayor, and he won by 10 votes. If 10 people had just stayed home, we wouldn't be here today.
Mrs. Sanders, is this process what you thought it would be?
Oh, I would say no.
How come?
Because it's so fast-paced. It's methodical for a while, and then all of a sudden, every week there are primaries, and there's 11 states in 1 week. So that makes it a little bit difficult. You can't be in all places at all times. I wish there were 48 hours in a day.
Does it hit you at times, at odd times? All that's at stake here, does it just jolt you at times?
It does. When I listen to him speak, or when we have meetings with Latino groups or Native Americans or up in Flint, Michigan, at these times I come away saying, you have to win. We have to do something. We have to help. And you realize how much is at stake.
You know, you have to be proud and sit back when you think about all the young people that are just so into voting for your husband.
Mm-hmm. It's very exhilarating because we knew that his ideas would resonate, but we didn't think they would be so fervent about it. And we didn't realize going in, I thought, well, the senior vote will be with him because he supported founded the Caucus to Defend Social Security. He almost single-handedly fought back to stop the chain CPI, which would have cut Social Security significantly. So I was thinking, okay, seniors would be with him, and the working class that, you know, that he's worked for unions and all this for many years. We didn't know that the millennials, he consistently is winning by huge margins, anybody under 30. But it says so much about our nation now. We think how wonderful for the future. They are completely against racial intolerance. They are completely engaged in the issues that we think are of the utmost importance, to have criminal justice reform, to have a comprehensive immigration system, to have higher education be affordable and accessible to everybody regardless of their circumstances. The hope that comes from them to him is both exciting because their vision for the future is the same as his, and it's also humbling because you feel there is no way we can ever let them down.
You know what I appreciate, and I hope other people appreciate too, is the civility by which whenever he debates Mrs. Clinton, you can tell that there's mutual respect there and mutual admiration, and I think that's lacking on the other side. That's a conscious effort, isn't it, to make sure that that's shown?
Yes, yes. And it's the worst in our, the worst thing for democracy is, I think, and he thinks, is to demonize your opponents, to tear down their character. It just suppresses the vote. It turns people off politics. And politics is the center of our democracy. If we want to have a healthy, vibrant democracy where there is strong voter participation, we should be debating the issues. We shouldn't be just trying to win at all costs. It's not something he's ever done. He's always been respected for that on both sides of the aisle, that even in debates down in the Senate, he will fight. He will be a real fighter against what he believes is wrong, but it won't be personal.
And you said, you know, he's been respected and respectful to a strong woman in Mrs. Clinton, because you yourself did not move to Washington, D.C. with him back when he was elected to the House of Representatives because you wanted to keep working.
Yeah, yeah. It was hard to give up work, especially I was working with kids, running the youth office in the city of Burlington. It was just the best job in the world, working with teenagers and middle schoolers. It was, I mean, who'd want to leave that? But now, maybe I'll be so fortunate as to bring that kind of outlook to the White House.
We're talking to Jane O'Meara Sanders, the wife of Bernie Sanders. Mrs. Sanders, the first time you and Bernie saw Larry David's impression of him, what were your thoughts?
Oh, my gosh. We were hysterical. I mean, he's brilliant. I mean, if we could have picked anybody, we would have picked Larry David, because he's one of the best there is. So he was on Saturday Night Live with him, and watching the two of them run lines together was quite fun.
That was just such a funny sketch. It really was. And watching with a 16-year-old who wish he could vote in this election, it was so important to have Bernie on SNL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it is amazing what an impact something like that has. So he became a household word, or should I say, huge became a household.
Absolutely.
That's true. That's very true. We know how important this state is, Illinois, in 2 weeks. What's the message you want to get across, Mrs. Sanders, to the people of Illinois?
Well, I want to encourage them to look at his issues, look at who he is, look at the fact that Vermont, yesterday, he just won all the delegates in his home state, which was a Republican state not too long ago, and is now a Democratic state. But the people who know him best trust him the most. The things he talks about are the things he believes in. He walks the talk. He doesn't say, I think we really need to deal with campaign finance reform, but I need a super PAC or pharmaceutical firm or fossil fuel industry or Wall Street money. He says, I'm going to do it differently. And then he does. Even though everybody says those things can't be done, he envisions what can be done, what should be done. He states it, and then he leads by example. And he almost always is successful. So what I would encourage your listeners to do is, no matter who they're supporting, mm-hmm. get out there and vote. Voter participation is too low in this country, and we need to have a vibrant democracy where people have their voices heard on top. And we're very concerned, and that's why he's running, that the decisions being made at both the political and economic level are resting in the hands of too few people. This is everybody's chance to say, nope, we're taking it back, the government, for the people, of the people, and by the people.
And it's so important to get out there and vote, because as we heard from you, Jane, at the beginning, that your husband only won by 10 votes when he was elected
right.
mayor of Burlington, Vermont. And seriously, 10 votes, that sounds funny, but that's absolutely true.
That is true.
And when he ran for Congress the first time, he lost by 3% because everybody said he couldn't win. 2 years later, he beat the incumbent by 17% because they realized the mistake they made. They thought, well, he can't win, so I'm going to vote for the establishment candidate. 2 years later, he won. When he was running for Senate, he was running against the richest man in the state of Vermont. Everybody said, he can't win. He can't compete with all that money. He won by a landslide because by then Vermonters had caught on.
Yeah.
That they can get what they want at the ballot box if they show up.
Do you see anything different in him in the past year? Are you noticing anything different in Bernie that you didn't notice or know about him a year ago?
I think what I've seen is a more humility, more sense of we need to do everything we can to address these issues. He's always thought that, and he's always been that way. Mm-hmm. But thinking about it intellectually, I see him feeling it even more because as we've gone across the country, we've met people we've never met. We've dealt with issues that we've never had to deal with in the state of Vermont. You know, looking at how, the immigration reform is huge. Criminal justice reform for the African-American community is incredibly important. The Latino community, the Native American communities that we have been meeting with only add to the foundation that he's always had of standing with those who are oppressed or who have been treated unfairly, whether it was union workers or women with breast cancer that couldn't afford the prescription drugs they have to pay for in this country. I mean, it's a broader scope and I think a more humbling job. So I expect that I thought I'd have to keep his feet on the ground,
yeah.
You know. And in fact, they're firmly planted even better than they ever were. So it's interesting to see not more ego, but less.
And is it true you started kindergarten when you were 3 years old?
I did. My dad was in the hospital and my mom had 5 kids and she had to go to work. He was in for about 2 years. So broken hip and all sorts of crazy stuff. So she convinced the kindergartner to let me in. And so by 4, I was the assistant teacher as far as I thought.
And
so maybe
now,
that's why we give us the audaciousness to think, well, we could do this.
And you're serving as his political advisor as well. He says you're his soulmate and advisor as well.
Well, we've been, we're husband and wife, but we were colleagues for 7 years before we got married. We're best friends. So we talk about everything and there's about a half dozen of us that have been around forever with him and we're working together as a team.
So Jane, that would continue, I'm guessing, should Bernie become the president, you would remain in that role, certainly as his wife, but as an advisor as well, right?
Yes, and it's not, but I'm not a kind of a policy advisor. I wouldn't want to have my own, particular area. I would be more, I think we're more likely to bring different perspectives to the issue.
Sure.
He thinks to think systemically. He tries to come up with overarching solutions, and I tend to be looking at it from the ground up, the human perspective, and say, well, that's not fair. How can we address this? So we're coming at it from two different positions. Maybe the yin and the yang.
Exactly. I was just going to say that because that's what it is. It's like a sounding board. You run things past one another and discuss it and come to a conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
How many years have you been married?
27.
And does he sing to you regularly?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. Oh, that CD that they did has fantastic Vermont artists on it. If I could extricate his voice, I would be very happy. It would be a bestseller because we have wonderful Vermont artists.
There's footage that came out a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure you're aware of it, of him playing the role of a rabbi in a very small film. Are you saddened that he didn't go on to a career in Hollywood?
No. First off, that film was awful, but I thought his piece on it was pretty good, actually.
It was. Yes, it was.
It's been one heck of a ride so far, hasn't it, Jane?
It has, and we're hopeful that we're making a difference, shifting the framework of the debate and talking about things in a positive way and offering solutions and alternatives for people. And what better can you do?
You seem to be doing that. Both of you do. So good. Nothing but good luck the rest of the way. As we said at the very beginning, this is an arduous, grueling process, and it doesn't come easy. But you guys are weathering it and doing the best, and continued success.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me on, and I will hopefully meet you in person sometime.
Would love to. And we'll all be out there March 15th for the primary here in Illinois. It's Jane O'Meara Sanders. Such a pleasure to talk to you, Jane.
Wonderful talking to you as well.
All right. Have a
Bye-bye.
Great day. Thank you so much. That's Bernie Sanders' wife, Jane O'Meara Sanders, spending some time with us. We'll take a quick break, and then a little bit more coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.